They have inverted crosses marked in blood. And as the woman goes to the altar, there's a strange power there, filling the whole house. I felt it. Strong, weird power.
Death is no prison to those who have given their souls to the Prince of Darkness.
So it's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show, Friday the 21st of April 2023, streaming live from the PRSC Arts Centre in Bristol, on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the glorious Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores, anything please, except Google. That's their Play Store, avoid it like the plague. I'm Tony Gosling. Thanks for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade psyops, smearing 30 pence a pill ivermectin. Remember that? The COVID treatment, which could have saved 60,000 British lives. Good old mainstream press, eh? Matt Hancock's crimes against humanity vanished in the Ukraine. Now turning a blind eye to failings of coke-snorting Zio-Nazi hero Zelensky and the masochistic Russian sanctions. An unhappy bunch of Goldman Sachs, Bilderberg, Nazi death trip, deep state losers, the Dark Enlightenment zombies, waging war on the British people now as well as Putin. So this is what the BBC might sound like, were it free of the tentacles of the authoritarian deep state Zionist lobby. Navigating us through the Fourth Reich matrix on the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. We also hope to be joined by Dr. David Hughes to talk about Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, one of his academic papers, a little bit later. This week, in part one, Dominic Raab forced to resign, whether he's actually bullied or not. He's saying that he's been told that if he didn't resign, he would be sacked. He's obviously decided he would much prefer to resign, a bit Kafkaesque. Is it anything to do with Brexit? Of course it might be. Is it anything to do with Otto von Habsburg? Also it might have something to do with it all. And it's also very likely to have something to do with Dominic Raab's comments when he was Foreign Secretary, discussing the Royal Navy's little excursion into Crimea, where the Russians shot at them, in negative terms, which is appalling. The idea that the Foreign Office might push back against the Defence Department or the Ministry of Defence and the Royal Institute for International Affairs. How dare he? So anyway, maybe he will live to fight another day. Who knows? More on the coronation. We've got something on allotments here in Bristol to start with. And in part two, Jens Stoltenberg. Remember him? He's that guy that says he's the head of NATO when he's trying to herd cats, apparently. But it helps to herd the cats when you control all the security apparatus right across the NATO countries and through the Bilderbergs, the politics of it too. So, yes, it's not quite as difficult as it would otherwise be if there was any democracy involved. Jens Stoltenberg's been to Kiev this week. Kiev. And also to Rammstein, which is the US outpost, a bit like Fairford or Mildenhall in the UK, over in Germany. Also, we hear some analysis from Ray McGovern about what's going on in Ukraine. And a taboo. I think it's nice to break taboos from time to time. Something this week about near-death experiences. Iranian and Russian news banned in the UK, first by the telecoms cartel and then by Ofcom. Us, cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia, but not cancelled here yet. Martin, let's start, if you want, with the... I'll just pass it over to you, this edition of the Bristolian. What do you make, over the years, this is a sort of little private eye that comes out in Bristol once a month. What do you make of the... Before we look at that particular story, what do you make of the publication as a whole?
Well, it's a part of Bristol life and has been since I've lived here, when I came here 20 years ago. So it's a free sheet that anybody can pick up, and you can pick them up in pubs and cafes and so on.
It's amazing what they pack into this there's basically four pages. It's a it's an A3 sheet folded over, and I find myself trying to get hold of it. It's, you know, you can't read all of this stuff on the website. They have a website, I think it's called thebristolian.net, which has some of their reporting in, but not this one particularly. The Faces of Evil is on the cover of this one, which I think is one of their best ever front covers, and it's got a picture of the four Bristol Labour MPs and their names. And it's, I mean, it's partly because of the Kill the Bill demonstration. Well, largely, that's what this is about in Bristol, which has led to so many people being jailed. So just to read from the Bristolian this week, at least 34 youngsters in our city have been jailed for, in total now, over 100 years after being assaulted by cops at the March 2021 Kill the Bill demos in Bristol. Many have been jailed under the Riot Act. More people were jailed for riot in Bristol last year than in 10 years of riots in Northern Ireland, and in the whole of the August 2011 Mark Duggan riots in the UK. Parents and supporters of youngsters caught up in this alarming miscarriage of justice and brutal, I mean, that's what we called it here on this programme a few weeks ago, and we've had a couple of the victims, one is a family and one person was sent to jail themselves, and brutal sentencing, have approached all of Bristol's MPs for support and to request help. They question the actions of Bristol's courts in a national forum nationally. No Bristol MP will take up the issue. Too stupid, too busy, too lazy, too scared. What are our MPs for? Well, that's a pretty good question they're putting there, isn't it? A very good point they're making. What are MPs for if they won't take up a cause of miscarriage of justice? And I think both you and I and anyone with more than just a half a brain cell can see that the sentencing is way over the top using the Riot Act for these prosecutions.
Well, the Bristolian would not be ashamed to claim that they are of an anarchist disposition. They are anarchists. They did stand people. There was a Bristolian candidate stood in Bristol at one stage, if you remember. They didn't do very well. They're good at...
Well, that's because of the system, as you point out, if it was somebody else.
Could be, indeed, it is because of the system. If there's a PR system, you could imagine
they may be running the city by now.
Well, yeah, well, the point is that they represent a very powerful strand of opinion in Bristol, and you know, it's not, you know, they are definitely part of Bristol life, and of course they are not going to be happy with these Labour MPs not wanting to question the sentencing or anything else to do with what happened on the Kill the Bill demo. The Labour MPs, I assume their calculation is, these people are, you know, it's not, we're not going to win votes by standing up for these people. And that will be their quite cynical calculation.
But they might they? They might well do, actually.
Well, somebody...
There's been a lot of criticism in, say, Bristol 24, in the local press, of the sentencing, for example.
Well, indeed, the sentencing probably is... You see, the problem is, it's partly to do with the sentencing, but when you've got the Bristolian, which is outwardly an anarchist organisation that actually, in some respects, wants confrontation with the police, you can see why the mainstream Labour Party people who want to win elections by persuading, basically, you know, middle of the road people to vote for them, they're scared of losing votes.
Do you know why people, some people want confrontation with the police? It's when there are miscarriages of justice and the criminal justice system isn't working.
I'm not disputing that there are issues here, Tony. I'm just trying to, you know, give listeners an understanding of the various, you know, wheels in motion here. I mean, I suspect that the original, what happened a few years ago with the Tesco riot was definitely a provocation organised presumably by the security services. And as we heard from the people who were at the demonstration the other week, the police came out of the police station armed up with full riot gear. And that was a provocation in itself.
Well, also they decided that they weren't allowed to protest there. They were going to move them on. So the riot started. Yeah, yes. If it was a riot, because there's a dispute about whether it was or not.
People dropping rocks and things from you know, I wasn't there, so I'm not going to make I'm not trying to dispute what happened or didn't happen because I didn't see it. People I know were there and they were phoning me and telling me what was happening, but I wasn't there. These kind of confrontations, I think, can be orchestrated by the intelligence services, and this is exactly what
they
we see.
They don't have to be orchestrated.
No, they don't. But the agent provocateurs
let's just
can
assume.
Do things.
Well, but Heidi certainly, when she came in to talk about it, said that she didn't think that there were the people who were doing the, for example, torching the allegedly the police van. That they were sentenced and they've gone down to do a stretch of time.
Well,
you know,
I understand that
surely that isn't the normal way for an agent provocateur to operate. Is it?
No, it isn't. And it could well be that people are just being a bit silly. I don't think you should go and try and set fire to a police van when you've got a CCTV camera on you. Maybe you should try and assassinate the Prime Minister. Yeah.
Is this why the anarchists like wearing masks?
Yes, and that's exactly why they do wear masks and why masks are supposedly illegal. And then they say that's why they wore them in Hong Kong. If you remember, you had the Hong Kong students on here. They were talking about that's why they wear masks.
But it is, I think, you know, when I pick up a copy of the Bristolian, I think this is all the stuff that they didn't put in the Bristol Post for the last month. And one of the stories, for example, here on the back page is heard about, it's not football, thank God, heard about the one about the disabled adult's boss. Useless fatso, former people boss at the council, Hugh Cares Evans, fresh from being fired from overseeing children's services after royally making a mess of and getting caught up spying on parents, has now been caught laughing at the disabled. A leaked email sent out to the SEND managers, this is SEND is special educational needs managers, who've already been really horrifically bullied by the council by basically unlawfully having their funding cut, would you believe? And then the legal challenge has done something to repair the damage done by this Labour council, this Labour mayor, to special educational needs people. He doesn't seem to care at all about them. Obviously, they're not fit and healthy enough and haven't got enough money. Managers and education directors, he incompetently managed, reveals him openly mocking a disabled parent's spelling. Hugh Cares, who for some reason is still allowed by the Reverend, that's the Mayor Robin Rees, to run adult care services for the council, has statutory responsibility for disabled adults in the city. We might therefore reasonably expect that he doesn't laugh at them in private. Does Hugh also liven up his dull meetings with his fawning social work managers with hilarious impressions of the learning disabled? And then they finish, can someone please put this useless twit out of our misery? I mean, these are quite serious points he's making about a disabled adult boss mocking the disabled people. I mean, these are the sorts of things that, you know, it's difficult to prove. And to be fair, Bristol Labour, you know, which you're a member, at the bottom here, apparently has said not a credible news source about the Bristolian.
They would say that, wouldn't they?
Which is, I mean, the thing is, and also, it's a laugh, it's brilliant. There's all sorts of different publications come out in Bristol, including a thing called the Bristol Cable. But for me, the Bristolian has got it 100, well, it's probably orders of magnitude better than anything else. I mean, various other headlines. This is one from last year. Cost of living crisis. Stay warm this winter. Mug the rich, it says. Do your own windfall tax. Well, obviously, there are some questions about whether you should. I mean, this is.
What do we mean by mug, Tony? Is that just a metaphor?
Yes.
It's a metaphor. That's okay.
It's a provocative
then.
Headline about the rich having far too much money and not being taxed enough.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you've got to read it with your tongue in your cheek because that's the sort of publication it is, and as you say, it's a bit of fun. And of course, Marvin Rees was very cross with them because they had a thing about beheading him. And of course,
it was a meat cleaver in his head, a cartoon of a meat cleaver in his head,
yeah.
Saying the best cut of all when he was doing loads of cuts.
Yes, okay.
And he apparently went to the police and said, "This is a credible threat to my personal
safety." He didn't like it.
Well, but the police said no, it isn't. So,
well, there you are. But you'll see what the tension is.
People understand that the political cartoon. If you're a politician, you've got to be able to take it on the chin, haven't you?
Or on the head.
Well, no, look.
With the cleaver.
You've got to be able to take criticism, but apparently our mayor has quite a fragile ego. Anyway, the point being made is everyone at the Bristolian, which is, I think, is connected with the Bristol Radical History people. Those are the people that put it out, isn't it?
Well, I think you can't really put there's an overlap of people involved.
I think that's
what I don't think Bristol Radical History would want necessarily to be tarred as Bristolian people.
Well, I think it's the
some
same.
Some are, some aren't.
It's the same kind of similar sort
well,
of
it's, yeah,
type.
It's the,
but anyway, they have a, yeah, thebristolian.net, one word, thebristolian.net, and they also have a phone number on there, which you can get on their website, bristoliannews@gmail.com. The fools, you Bristolian losers, using Gmail, use a proper email, please. An interesting story anyway. Police have been called this week to an allotment standoff on the edge of Bristol as work has begun on a project, Tristan Cork writes in the Bristol Post yesterday. Police were called after an attempt to create a large allotment project on the edge of Bristol was held up by angry neighbours. The entrance lane to Lee Woods, a firm setting up a new model of commercial allotments, is trying to begin work. Roots Allotments want to turn a field next to the main road in Abbotsley into 700 allotment plots and rent them out to people from across Bristol and North Somerset. Local residents in the village are battling to stop them, saying they should get planning permission because of the impact of the project. A group of young entrepreneurs set up Roots after the COVID lockdown and have been running a smaller site on the edge of Bath for a couple of years. So apparently they haven't got planning permission, but this is a bit of a standoff here. This is typical of Bristol City Council, because they just sort of say tick, 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 and they kind of ignore local feeling. Obviously, it's running quite strongly here.
Well, I can't see how they can proceed unless they have got planning permission. So
I guess what they're saying is, well, it's a field now. It's only going to be these, like, we're dividing it up into lots of little fields, so we don't need planning permission.
All right. Well, that may be the argument. I mean, obviously, it's the first I've heard of this, so I'm just.
Well, it's the first I've seen of it, too. Yeah.
So, okay. Well, I mean, I don't know what to say about that. If you're going to have lots of allotments, people are going to be coming and going in cars and so on.
So that was
so that's clearly got a planning
the
implication.
The council really doesn't seem to understand that there are people living in the city that they do need to actually work with. Council tells allotment company Roots to stop work. This is today after residents' revolt 3 hours ago. Company wanting to create a huge allotment on the edge of Bristol been told to stop work and wait until council planners have decided if they need planning permission or not. Local residents physically blocked tractors and lorries from accessing the field this week. Tractors sound like an allotment.
Well, they've got to climb it up, haven't they, if they're going to turn it into allotment.
Maybe. Council representatives visited the field on Wednesday, which is on the main A369 road through Abbotsley at the corner of turning into Lee Woods. That is right next to Business West and Common Purpose, by the way, this little Masonic conclave on the edge of Bristol. They said they have told Roots Allotments, which already run two commercial allotment sites in Bath, they mustn't do anything until the planning decisions have been made. But no doubt, because the mayor likes to interfere in planning decisions, they have already decided that they will give them planning permission, perhaps, since the planning permission and the whole planning system in Bristol is in a bit of a mess at the moment and largely and possibly even unlawfully being influenced by the mayor's office. A spokesperson for North Somerset Council said planning officers have advised Roots that they should not do anything more until the legal arguments over whether they have to go through a full planning application process first are completed.
But North Somerset? So in other words, it's nothing to do with Bristol City Council at all?
Is it outside Bristol? Oh, okay. Planning officers,
so there we are.
Okay, it's just that, okay, that maybe that is the
is
actual
this the BBC?
Boundary.
The alternative BBC?
This? No. I'm just reading this thing out here and making assumptions about what council it is. It's not Bristol City Council, apparently. So certificate of lawful use, tell them they need to submit a full planning application. I mean, it is the so-called planning free-for-all, though, isn't it?
That's a more general point than the mayor's office in Bristol influencing the planning in Bristol. Yes, the planning system's a mess. Of course it is.
I mean,
it's far too in favour of developers.
What this Tory government have said is we're basically taking off the reins, you know, we're letting go of the reins so that people who want planning permission can just kind of do what they want. And
well, that's one of the problems that they had in the southeast, in the Tory constituencies in the southeast, because they, you know, they were basically the developers fund the Tory party, but of course lots of Tory voters do not want developments in their backyard, and therefore they're facing both ways on it, and they're not quite sure which way to jump. This is North Somerset Council, which is Tory-controlled, I believe, and they will no doubt, these people who want to do some entrepreneurial things are being given maybe given permission, or they may not, because obviously, you know, locals may say we don't want this at all.
It's interesting. It looks to me as if this might be some sort of allotment that people are designed to sort of drive across the city to it, because it's larger than normal allotments.
Well, if you're going to go to an allotment, it's likely that you're going to have to go in a vehicle because you've got to take things like space, unless you've got a shed. Or, you know, it's definitely going to have a planning implication. It's like opening a pub or anything. It's going to have a planning implication, isn't it? You know, things like traffic and parking, obvious things for that people are going to be concerned about.
Have you ever had an allotment yourself?
Nope. I know people who have, but
I
never.
Do you have any urge to do that sort of thing?
Well, no, because it's just I haven't got the time for an allotment. I wouldn't. You know, I'm perfectly happy for people to have allotments. They're obviously a good thing in many respects, but I've never had one.
Our other story from the local press this week is bus cuts again. This so appalls me when they're trying to charge everyone from using their cars, getting people to sell their cars, older cars, people who are poorer, and get on a bus. Basically, that's what they're trying to do, nudge people from an old car onto the bus. Bristol bus cuts. Residents are stuck on estate after last service is cut. Bristol is the only major city in Britain that has working-class communities with no bus services. The situation is shocking. A veteran transport campaigner has said people in one part of Bristol now cut off from the rest of the city begin yet another campaign to get their bus service back. Most recent and biggest set of cuts announced by First Bus and WECA, West of England Combined Authority, that's Dan Norris, former Labour MP, and I think it's Jacob Rees-Mogg's seat, is unable to get to work and school, with some communities left with no bus services at all. In Ashton Vale, a council estate originally built mainly for the elderly and disabled, residents say they are discriminated against after First Bus scrapped the only bus service. Council travel chiefs left them out of a replacement scheme called Westlink, which sees people use an app or on a smartphone to order a bus to come along. The damning verdict on Bristol's bus services, how it has disproportionately affected working class communities, came from Dave Redgewell, a veteran campaigner, advocate for transport and disability issues at Bristol City Council's Overview and Scrutiny Management on Tuesday. He slammed WECA for leaving entire communities behind. So we've got situations now where there's just people are just left to, I suppose, walk or maybe even go on a bike.
Well, there's no NHS dentistry. There's all sorts of things going wrong, and this is the result. I mean, the bus service used to be run by the local council and was directly responsible to the local council and was subsidised by the local council, because you have to subsidise certain routes if you're going to have a network system. But we privatised the buses, you remember it in the 1980s, Tony, and this is the result decades later, especially when we've got austerity, because we've got to send loads of money to the Ukraine, we've got to bail the banks out, and we've got to have tax cuts for the wealthy before the next election. This is why we're here. People, if you carry on doing this stuff for decades and decades, this is what happens. The idea that somehow the welfare state and the infrastructure of things like buses will just carry on is wrong. We're going to find out how wrong that is. It needs to be changed, obviously. Shouldn't have been checked. Shouldn't be here.
Well, we need to have a mixed economy, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, yes, we did. We used to have one.
We need to have one now. And before, everything is just privatised. And the fascist move in, really, the big corporations controlling our infrastructure.
That is the danger, is that what is going to happen in Europe now is there is going to be a prolonged depression. Not a recession, a depression.
And if people don't have jobs, do you know what can happen? Do you know what happened in Germany in the 1930s?
Well, exactly. It's going to be the Germans who are going to take the brunt of this. And therefore, I mean, if you've got any historical knowledge at all, the idea of impoverishing the Germans in order to achieve any political goal, you can see what the consequence of that might be. But it may not be them that will be where the kickoff comes. It's because you've got all these other potential conflicts all over Europe. You know, what about the banlieue in France, where you've got, you know, very, very disaffected Muslim youth that have been born in France and no jobs and no jobs in prospect? You can see where this could all end up.
Dominic Raab. Snowflake Central. Dominic Raab's camp condemns a report that ruled he had bullied and intimidated civil servants who complained he interrupted them in meetings, as he is forced to quit the government with a blast at the bureaucrats who can't hack it. Dominic Raab, mandarins couldn't handle the pace, the standards and the challenge that he brought. He fell on his sword after an independent probe has upheld 2 of 8 complaints. So this guy was deputy prime minister. I think it's, isn't it? This is the job I think Peter Mandelson had under Gordon Brown. which is Minister Without Portfolio or something, is it? Deputy Prime Minister, yeah. Or Duchy of...
No, that's the Duchy, Duchy of Lancaster is a different one. Deputy Prime Minister is... I can't remember the exact history of it. It's a relatively recent role. But anyway, he was it, as you're saying.
Yeah, so allies have branded the bullying claims against him Snowflake Central. So what do you make, anyway, of this whole process? I mean, the first, really, Dominic Raab came up on my radar as somebody that might actually even be vaguely interesting in an otherwise very uninteresting Tory cabinet under Theresa May. No, I think it was Theresa May. No, Boris. Was when he spoke out about the Royal Navy destroyer going buzzing the Russians in Crimea and making out that the waters around the Crimea were Ukrainian waters, and so they were friendly with the Ukrainians, so they could go and sail in there. This was, I think, about a year and a half ago. And he spoke out about that, didn't he? He said this was a silly thing to do when he was Foreign Secretary.
I'd have to check. I mean, I know I was aware that he wasn't happy about it, and quite right so, because it's a stupid thing to do. But that doesn't necessarily mean that he doesn't bully people in meetings. These are two separate things, aren't they?
A lot of these are allegations, aren't they? They're not really substantiated.
Well, there's been an independent inquiry.
Is there such a thing?
Well, in that case, we could just sack him if we don't need an inquiry, Tony.
Yeah.
For political reasons, he should just be sacked because he's caused a load of problems for the government. If Sunak was in a stronger position, he would have just sacked him, because I can do that. I'm the Prime Minister. I decide everybody's position. If you're causing me an embarrassment...
That's not the way investigation works. It's not the way things work, though,
no, because there's an investigation, Tony.
It's not the way things work.
No,
What would have happened last night is that Sunak would approach Raab and saying, if you don't resign, I'm going to sack you.
That's because the investigation has found him guilty. And according to the Civil Service Code, which is what got rid of Priti Patel, there are things you can and can't do at work. I can be sacked at work if I don't fulfil what my job description says. Okay? That's the same for them, isn't it? Now, there's either an independent procedure, which there is in this case, which may or may not be fair, or you don't have to have, in politics, you don't have to have any procedure at all. If you're being a nuisance, I can just sack you for my political reasons. There's no, I don't have to give a reason. You're just embarrassing the government. You've got to go.
Yeah, so Raab has accused the Mandarins of not being able to hack his high standards as he quit as Deputy Prime Minister. I'm not sure there's any actual real evidence that's been published of him. Martin, can you stop interrupting the whole time? I just start a sentence and then you decide, no. Because why is it that you're not interested in hearing why Sunak might have sacked Raab and gotten rid of him because of political reasons? It's almost certain to be political, isn't it?
It's going to be political.
No, isn't it certain that there's some sort of political rivalry there?
Yes.
That Raab is actually maybe a threat to Sunak, and that's why he's got rid of him. Nothing to do with bullying.
There are politics in this, of course there are, and part of the politics of it is following the proper procedures for cabinet ministers. They have a job description as other people have a job description. If you do not fulfil all of the pieces in your job description, and an independent inquiry by HR finds that you have not done that,
Do you really believe in independent inquiries?
No. I believe in independent inquiries. Whether this is one or not is a question.
Okay. Mr. Raab's conduct in the department had a significant adverse effect on one colleague, and he was also found to have been intimidating to staff. Now, a lot of these things are actually quite subjective, aren't they? Criticising useless work whilst Justice Secretary. So if he sees a civil servant that comes up with work which is useless, should he say so, or should he pretend that it's okay?
The civil servant might have the view that he is the one who's useless. Just because he's your line manager doesn't mean he's right, does it?
But it cleared him. It doesn't mean he's your boss, though. He is elected. But it cleared him, it said, of shouting or swearing at staff or raising his arms in a threatening manner. Some of the complaints made about him. It also revealed some complainants had never even met him, but were supporting colleagues. So they were complaining about him just on hearsay. Now, this isn't really proper evidence that has been put forward, is it?
Well, it's the evidence that this is the evidence that the civil service uses to make these kind of judgments. Now, we could get rid of the civil service and just have everything run by politicians, Tony. Do you think that'd be a good idea? Just for people, elected people, then they can... In America, of course, they can. When you're elected, you bring your own civil servants with you. In Britain, we have a tradition of an independent civil service, which can work for any government, and there are rules and regulations surrounding all of that. Now, you might argue that we don't need any rules and regulations. I'm sure the Bristolian would agree with you, but I'm not really an anarchist, and I think ultimately you have to have rules and regulations.
On this show, we've had quite a lot of Prime Minister's questions where... Rab is standing in for Rishi Sunak. One of the problems, and one of the things I noticed with Rab during those sessions, is he does actually seem to address the question more than Sunak. Sunak seems to just completely ignore the question. And, you know, it's quite likely, surely, that I mean, it's a little bit like the whole situation with Robin Cook and Tony Blair, that the last thing a rather weak leader like Sunak wants is to have somebody quite strong sitting by his side. Having him out of the way is going to make life a lot easier for Sunak, isn't it?
Well, the politics of this for Sunak are slightly more complex than that. He was forced to accept Rab into his cabinet in order to keep the right wing of the Tory party happy. So this now puts him in a quandary, because he's got to sack Rab according to what this report has suggested. Because if you're found guilty of even one offence, you're supposed to be sacked. This is, you know, the Tories, when Sunak came to power, he said, I'm going to clean, you know, we're going to get back to doing it by the book. Because that's exactly what wasn't happening under Liz Truss and Boris Johnson. Now, this is the book. He's now got to move against Sunak, or he probably will. I understand that he has been forced to resign, but that will make the right wing of the Tory party more likely to try and overthrow Sunak, especially if they do very badly in the May local elections coming up. They may decide they've got one more throw of the dice before a general election and stab Sunak in the back. Don't rule it out. They're mad enough to do that.
They certainly are. A serving government whip, Joy Morrissey, tweeted, sadly, we now live in a country where the definition of bullying includes telling someone to do their job, where the slightest upset or annoyance is indulged with endless reports and inquiries. Alex Chalk, the former prisons minister, was in the afternoon named as the new Justice Secretary, while Oliver Dowden, a long-term Sunak ally, is the new Deputy PM. My impression is that Sunak has got a bit of backbone, and he will stand up to Sunak, and that he is the sort of person who will speak his mind at cabinet. And maybe we're living in a world now where our cabinet is. I mean, we're talking about a bunch of people that just simply sit there and nod everything through, which is very dangerous.
Well, in actual fact, prime ministerial government has been coming to this country for many decades, Tony. Do you imagine that Boris Johnson allowed anybody in his cabinet that he wasn't completely happy with? Now, what's happened with this cabinet, Sunak's cabinet, that in order to become prime minister, he had to bring in people he wouldn't want in there, who are basically his political rivals, let's not say enemies, rivals. So he had to bring Rab in to keep those kind of people happy. He's now had to sack him, and those people are going to be cross. Therefore, as I say, if they do badly in the local elections in May, it could be that Rab will be one of those people saying, we've got to get rid of Rishi Sunak. What the wider electorate are going to think of the Tories having another round of internal infighting is another matter.
Yeah, so you think he may be bouncing back before the next general election?
I think the way he's phrased, you know, he's asked people to brief, is that he's not saying, well, I'm, you know, if he was going to help Sunak, he would just go quietly so that Sunak could carry on. What he's trying to do is saying, I'm not having it, he's moaning and bawling. And that means that they are going to plan, I think there will be people planning to remove Sunak. We know that. There are at least 100 Tory MPs anyway, who don't want him to be Prime Minister.
Dominic Rab made it clear in his resignation letter published on Twitter that he did not agree with the findings. He said he stepped down because he had pledged to do so if the report went against him, a decision backed by the Prime Minister today. In a stinging attack on the civil service, Mr. Rab said, Mr. Tolley concluded, I had not once in 4.5 years sworn or shouted at anyone, let alone thrown anything. Because there's been all sorts of allegations here, haven't they? They've been circulated as if they're facts. Or otherwise physically intimidated anyone, nor intentionally sought to belittle anyone. I'm genuinely sorry for any unintended stress or offence that any officials felt as a result of the pace, standards and challenge that I brought to the Ministry of Justice. That is, however, what the public expected of ministers working on their behalf. Former Tory leadership contender quit following a day of agonising by the Prime Minister over whether to sack him after he received Adam Toddy KC's report. So it's going to be all over the Sunday papers, no doubt, and possibly, I think, that Dominic Raab sent an article in today's Daily Telegraph as well.
Well, I imagine the Tory right, from what you've just been saying, they're rallying around the idea that we've got to get rid of the civil service. They're an obstacle to our will. And the civil service, you could say, as I say, in the US, when you get a new president or a congressperson elected, they bring all of their officials with them. They are really all just yes people for the politicians. And of course, that does lead to some rather poor decisions in the US, because they haven't actually... Look at somebody like Lavrov, for example, the French... Not French, the Russian foreign minister. He is a top civil servant. And he can run rings around the foreign ministers of NATO countries who are elected... know-nothings.
The state of British justice under Dominic Raab, I mean, he's obviously caught quite an awkward job there, hasn't he, trying to bash them into shape, or maybe he's responsible for the disaster that is British. I mean, we're just talking about this appalling decision about, 100 years in jail for these people and being accused of riot and the Kill the Bill march. Well, I mean, this is, you know, miscarriages of justice right on our doorstep here.
Well, I doubt very much whether if you can see these four Labour MPs aren't prepared to speak out about that, you can be quite sure that Dominic Raab will definitely be on the send them down for 200 years. That's what the right wing of the Tory party want. And he's one of them.
When you say the right wing of the Tory party, what do you mean?
Every party is split.
But it's not necessarily right. There is a sort of, what you might call it, is an internationalist and a nationalist wing, isn't there? There's a pro-America, pro-empire, pro-EU wing, which is represented by Sunak, and then there is all sorts of others in there. They're not necessarily more right-wing.
No, all right, well, let's if you want to parse it further, Sunak is not, in fact, there are no what we would call left-wing Tories left. Michael Heseltine has been removed from the Conservative Party. He sits in the Lords as a crossbench peer. So he was somebody that was touted as a Tory Prime Minister back in the 1980s and so on. He's not in the Tory Party anymore. So the whole Tory Party has moved to the right. Now, within that new Tory Party, if you like, there's still nuances. There's a big split on the in the Tory Party between the free marketeers, who want Britain to be globalised, and therefore, for example, lower taxes, Singapore on Thames. They, in actual fact, are in favour of immigration, but not from the EU. And then you've got the, what you might call traditional Tories, who are, in the Red Wall seats, for example, people who voted Tory because they expected more public expenditure. I don't know why they imagined that was going to happen, but that's what they thought was going to happen. And therefore, there is a dialogue goes on across the political spectrum anyway. There are more libertarian people who are in favour, for example, some Tories are in favour of the legalisation of drugs, for example. None of these Labour MPs are apart from Fangham, possibly. You can see that all of these issues, you know, people can't be just parked in any particular slot.
Well, you can certainly do that with Dominic Raab, because he's nowhere near as gung-ho for Russia as many of the rest of them.
Well,
Dominic
I think
Raab,
he
is not. Listen, do you want to listen or not?
Yeah.
Am I allowed to speak? Says Tony. Dominic Raab questioned whether the Ministry of Defence should send a British destroyer into contested Crimean waters before the dramatic confrontation with the Russians in the Black Sea. Foreign Secretary, remember he was Foreign Secretary at the time, not Liz Truss, him, said to have had a dispute with the Defence Secretary Ben Wallace. HMS Defender is involved in an international incident in international shipping lane passed close to Ukraine, and this was in June 2021. Senior Minister Dominic Raab raised concerns about a decision to send a Royal Navy warship through contested Crimean waters before a confrontation with Russian forces. He's said to have been in dispute with the Foreign Secretary Ben Wallace. The Type 45 destroyer was involved in an international incident after using an international shipping lane that went very close to the Ukrainian peninsula. Are they calling it Ukrainian? It's actually Russian, which is illegally occupied and claimed by Russia. So the route was pre-planned, but he, as Foreign Secretary, said, what are you doing? Now, it does suggest that there are various players in these kind of manoeuvres, isn't it? The Foreign Office and Dominic Raab are saying don't do it. The Royal Institute for International Affairs and these, I would say right-wing, you probably say left-wing, think tank, privately funded foreign policy think tank, would be very much for this kind of thing, as would, say, for example, the Ministry of Defence.
Well, I think Dominic Raab probably was there channelling the senior civil servants in the Foreign Office. And I think it's good that he said what he said. But of course, if you look at his general position on the Ukraine, it is they must fight to the finish and all the rest of it. Nobody in the mainstream is saying anything different. I'm glad that he spoke up there. And of course, it was Boris Johnson who was Prime Minister at the time.
It's the sort of thing that can get you a mark, a little black book.
Yeah, I think,
of course, he was shuffled out of the Foreign Office after that.
Yeah, well, he had to leave the Foreign Office because he was on the beach in Cyprus when all these British occupation of Afghanistan
any
collapsed.
Excuse, you know as well as I do, any excuse to get rid of them, you know?
Well, no, I think, you see, Tony, I'm willing to debate about these things, but if you're going to debate about it, you can't just presume that your conspiracy theory about it.
It's not a conspiracy theory. This is realpolitik, I think.
No,
if you as Foreign Secretary are going to weigh in against the Ministry of Defence and against the Royal Institute for International Affairs and people like that and say this was a stupid thing to do,
mm-hmm.
and when there is a policy to start a war with Russia, then you're going to get into trouble and you might find your political career will be over.
Yes, and it's not been over until today. Because he was
it takes a little while, doesn't it?
Yes.
To chug through. They keep a little note of this, you know?
Yes. It won't have done him any favours with the wrong people. You're right. And I'm glad.
Is it possible he's the one who's been bullied?
I don't think we know enough to know that, Tony.
Anyway, I'm saying, is it possible?
I think that he is actually a rather unpleasant individual. The fact that he said the right thing about what's happening in the Crimea, good. But, of course, the general policy of the Tory government has been to make war on Russia. And he's part of that government.
That will have been noted, and they'll say, you'll keep. You'll keep, won't
but
they?
But if you remember, he lost his job as Foreign Secretary because he was on holiday during the collapse in Afghanistan.
That was the excuse that was used.
If
they've decided they're going to get you, they will find anything, like they did with Boris, to get rid of you.
Well, there are different ways to get rid of all sorts of people. I mean, politics is full of stabs in the back, stabs in the front. That's the nature of the beast,
that
Tony.
That we can definitely agree on. Anyway,
Julius Caesar had to fight Pompey and all the rest of it.
Of course.
You know, that's what goes on.
Another interesting one this week, CBI boss Tony Danker has said his reputation has been totally destroyed. The former boss of the business group giant, the CBI, says his reputation was destroyed after being fired over complaints about his behaviour. The actual behaviour, apparently, I mean, it doesn't sound at all bad to me. He organised a private karaoke party for 15 people after a Christmas work event. Sackable offence? Viewing an Instagram account of other staff at the CBI. Is that a sackable offence? I mean, that's publicly available online. Sending non-work-related messages to staff on work messaging platforms. Well, maybe he's thinking, well, this is the easiest way to message them. And, you know, I find this incredible. Inviting junior staff to breakfasts, lunches and one-off meetings. So as people are just arriving in the place, he's saying, come on, let's just, you know, let's get it together and have it. Now, I find it incredible, really incredible, that the guy's been sacked for these. If you want me to read them out again, a secret karaoke party, well, private karaoke party, for 15 people after a Christmas work event, viewing Instagram accounts of staff, sending a non-work-related message to staff on work messaging platforms and inviting junior staff to breakfast.
Well, I do not know what exactly went on here any more than you do. What I will say this is, as of somebody who's worked for many years in all sorts of organisations, you do get sacked. I've been sacked many times. And it's not necessarily fair, but they're basically, you're in a position, if you're an employee, where the employer can sack you.
Someone has said he's a marked man, a bit like Raab, and just gotten rid of him by whatever means.
Well be that he's got political enemies within the organisation who've got rid of him, but we don't know who they are or what their motivation is.
Something a little bit Hitlerian about these attacks.
Well, the whole environment, Tony, is if you like, Hitlerian in what you're saying.
You know,
because if as an employee, you haven't got a lot of powers.
You don't know, but someone has put a little black mark against your name and they're going to find any excuse to bully you out and get rid of you. Sacked CBI chief has also, of course, lost his role at the King's Charity. Tony Danker has forfeited the prestigious position on the advisory panel at Business in the Community. The King's favourite business charity. Danker was given a seat on a six-person panel advising Business in the Community in 2020. He forfeited his unpaid but highly prestigious role at the charity on Tuesday as a consequence of his dismissal from his £376,000 a year job as Director General of the CBI. His Majesty has been a driving force behind BITC for four decades. This sounds like a sort of British version of the World Economic Forum. For four decades, and its royal founding patron. Of course, they won't be paying any tax, no doubt. BITC is dedicated to encouraging businesses to be socially responsible and help build a fairer and greener world. So King Charles doesn't have to put up with him either, not just the CBI.
Well, I presume that's because... the rumour out there is that he's basically been coming on to the younger staff and all the rest of it, although, I don't know what's happened
You know, this is just the sort of thing that was been spread about Raab, which has proved to be unfounded report.
In the Raab case, there has been an investigation, and he's been found guilty on two counts.
And
that's it.
Not guilty on the whatever it is, 18 others.
No, but you only have to be found guilty on one to be sacked.
Yeah, well, this is why they've thrown so many at him.
Well, indeed. So one of them is stuck.
This one's rubbish, and that one, and that one, and that one, and that one.
In any case, what happens in many jobs is you don't have to do anything to get sacked, because the bosses decide whether you're employed or not.
If I go around to the school as some sort of inspector and ask every single member of staff individually, do you know anything bad about Martin Summers, compile a list of it all, that doesn't really make it an unbalanced balanced report, does it?
Well, no, I'll tell you this. I've had many unfair sackings in my working life.
Me too, yeah.
So there you go. And I could go through all the detail, but it's hardly worth boring people with it.
I don't think it's actually boring. I think both of these are very interesting. And what I'm seeing is an almost kind of feudal system that's bypassing democracy by saying, I don't like this person here. I don't like the cut of their jib. So let's find any excuse and boot them out.
Well, there's a deep state which has basically controlled this country for many decades, and they're becoming more and more powerful and arrogant. But, of course, the way they're able to do that is having emergencies that we're all supposedly freaking out about, whether it's Bin Laden or Ukraine or COVID or whatever it is. And, of course, we're all going to be woken up from our hangovers on Sunday afternoon by an alarm call. This is the kind of world we're living in. It's not new, Tony. It's been there for years, and it's getting worse.
What do you make of this alarm call, then?
Well, I mean, it seems to me an idiotic idea. I can't see the point of it. It doesn't. It could cause problems. The AA and the RAC have said, "Well, what about people in cars? People driving lorries?" And I just can't see that they have to do this. But I would see it as more of a kind of we're getting the population ready for when we really mobilise for war with Russia, and then we're going to be sending you text messages about this, that, and the other.
Oh, watch out, missile heading for your city. Get into the bunker now.
Yeah, well, it's
a bit like a kind of air raid warning siren, maybe.
Yeah, but what it is it's creating... did you see that there's been somebody speaking this week, I can't remember who it was, about how the Russians are going to hack everything, so that we're going to have more powers to deal with all this hacking that the Russians are doing. They're hiding in your computer. They're coming to get you, Tony. And we've got to do something about
it. Well, I think I will put a link up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to a rather nice article in The Independent, How to Turn Off the Emergency Alert on iPhones and Android. The message will make it clear that it's just a test, but in future it could include important life-threatening information, fires, floods. Some organisations have expressed fears that those tests could actually endanger some people. As you said, those at risk of domestic or sexual abuse may have hidden phones, for example. The loud alert could draw attention to those devices.
Exactly. There's all sorts. This is a massive experiment. It's like a sort of, we do school fire alarms every year. There's a fire alarm once a year. But, why would you need a fire alarm for the whole country? It doesn't make sense. They can hack the phones. We know they can. So if you know you can hack them, if there was an emergency, you could hack the relevant phones, couldn't you? Why do you need to hack everybody's phone just once, just to find out what happens? What's the point? I think it's a kind of conditioning of the population, really, isn't it? That's what it is. There's no point to it. I can't see any point to it.
It's a bit Big Brotherish, isn't it? Big Brother's telling you this. Big Brother's telling
that's
you
that. That's right. So we're getting used to the idea that this sort of thing can happen.
I'm reminded of Sandy Adams and her zero trust agenda. This is the idea that the government is there to tell you what to do and tell you what's best for you. Actually, the idea is that you're pretty stupid and you haven't got a clue what's best for you. The government's much better advised than you are.
Well, that's right. We're moving. Obviously, things are moving in a very authoritarian direction, and it's going to accelerate. Oh. And it's time for people to wake up.
In a nutshell, on this, I won't read the whole thing out, but this rather nice little article explains: on an iPhone, open up the Settings app and type "Emergency Alerts" in the search bar. That should bring up the option to turn off severe alerts and emergency alerts. On an Android device, once again, go to the Settings app and search for "Emergency Alerts." The wording of the switch might depend a little on what version you're using, but will usually be something like "emergency alerts" and have the option to turn it off. Devices that are switched off, connected to Wi-Fi only, or using a 2G, 3G network will not receive the alert. It requires more recent operating systems, though any device that has received updates from the last few years should be compatible, from news to politics, travel to sport, blah, blah, blah. That's what they're saying. Get this in your inbox. So that's Yahoo News talking about that. Sorry, no, it's The Independent. Turn off the emergency alert on iPhone and Android. How to. So that's how you make sure that your phone doesn't interrupt you while you're driving or surprise you when you're actually trying to relax or wake you up.
So when the missile is fired from Moscow, people won't be warned because they'll have cleared their phones.
Yeah, well, you mean from Washington, and then they say it's from Moscow.
Well, I don't know. I'm just
do you remember
being flippant?
Martin, I'm sure you remember. This is about 3 or 4 years ago when they did a Trident missile test from a Trident submarine, and accidentally the Trident missile started heading for North America rather than the North Sea.
Yes, because it was fired in the Caribbean, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Dear. Whoopsie-daisy. So maybe the Russians hacked that one too. So I think you've got to be extremely careful with all this stuff. And certainly I don't trust these alerts, and hopefully now you've got the information if you want to switch your phone in so it won't get that alert. Anyway, Rishi Sunak, you work in schools, don't you? So very appropriate that we should, I think, hear a little speech from Rishi Sunak about maths, Martin.
We're one of the few developed countries where young people don't routinely study some form of maths up to the age of 18. They do it in Australia, Canada, France, Germany, Finland, Japan, Norway, and America. Why should we accept any less for our children? Of course we shouldn't. That's why I set out in January that we're going to change the way our system works so that everyone in our country will study some form of maths all the way to 18. So it will take time to implement this change, but we are taking the first step today by identifying the maths content that will give our 16 to 18-year-olds the skills they need to get on in life. And when we have that, then we'll come back with a detailed plan to deliver it. I'll just finish on a personal note. Every opportunity that I've had in life began with the education that I was so fortunate to receive. And maths was a critical part of that. Now, I knew it was important then, and when I look at how the world is changing, it's only going to be more important for my children and yours. So I won't sit back and allow this cultural sense that it's okay to be bad at maths to put our children at a disadvantage. We've got to change this. We've got to value maths and what it can do for our children's futures. Giving our children a world-class education is the single most important thing we can do. It's the closest thing we have to a silver bullet, the best economic policy, the best social policy, the best moral policy. And that's why I'm proud that it's our policy, and I will never stop striving to achieve it. Thank you.
So how good are you at maths, Martin?
Well, I'm not brilliant, but I'm okay.
So did you do O-level, A-level?
I did O-level maths, but I didn't do A-level, because obviously in Britain, you specialise at A-level, which is what they don't do in other countries. When he's talking about other countries studying maths till 18, that's because they're a baccalaureus system, where you have to actually study. You don't get to choose what you study. You get to study what you have to study till you're 18. You know, in this country, at 16, you can choose what you want to further study. Mm. In other countries, you can't. And you have to study maths, and you have to go to university.
So is he right?
I think there's a there are issues here about maths, but let's just unpick some of this. First of all, the system in this country is the A-level system. Now, A-levels in Britain are harder than baccalaureate exams elsewhere, because you specialise early. So I did economics A level, and that is equivalent to a first year university A level course in the United States of America, for example. So in general, British young adults going to university have actually got a higher level of understanding of the subjects they've studied than children in the rest of Europe. Okay, so what he's actually suggesting there is we should move to a baccalaureate system. Now, there's a case for that. There is a case for that, but it's not actually the way the British system has worked, and it's not the system that Rishi Sunak himself was involved in. He was allowed to specialise in maths age 16, and therefore he studied it more intensively than he otherwise would have done. Because if we had a baccalaureate system, he'd also have to do some more poetry and foreign languages, for example, and not concentrate on maths. So it shows that he doesn't really understand how the British system works. That's what I'd say, first of all.
Secondly,
I would say, as the Labour Party have pointed out, it's all very well saying we're going to have more maths. We haven't got enough maths teachers to teach maths up to the age of 16. There's a big gap. And the reason why there's a big gap is because people who've got maths education can always go into the private sector and earn a lot more money than they can earn teaching maths. And, of course, that's of importance, because next week British schools will be on strike precisely because of the pay of teachers, including maths teachers.
I mean, one of the reasons, surely, that they want more maths is because they want to turn everyone into these kind of computers to do programming all the time, and that this is the right... So I can remember, actually, at the BBC, in the creative side of it, we were rather annoyed that these accountants were being trained up to be video editors. So the idea of somebody is good at maths or sciences, that they can... you know, they're good people to turn into creative types who they don't necessarily don't have any aptitude for the arts. They're perfect to put in there because then they're easy to manipulate.
Well, that's possibly so. I mean, maths is important, and nobody suggests that it isn't. And of course, the Chinese know that very well, which is why they send a lot of their young people to do further degrees in engineering and maths, what they call STEM, science, technology, engineering, and maths. They are actually outcompeting the whole world in producing high level postgraduates who are able to design new technology and all the rest of it, which is another reason why the US is so terrified of them, because what they've done over the last 30 years is they've deindustrialized the United States, just as Britain's been deindustrialized, and you don't need so many engineers because all the engineers are somewhere else. And Britain has now specialized in what you call the creative stuff. We do loads of nice film programs, documentaries, arts, producing modern spacecraft, not so much, you know. That's left to the Chinese, isn't it?
Well, yeah, so I think there's this kind of obsession with people who have got scientific mathematical brains being in charge. I mean, it's almost like rule by accountants.
Well, I think that's a fair comment. The idea that, the only people who really know what to do are the bean counters is wrong. And, of course, it leads to big problems in economics, because you've got people working in the City of London doing derivatives trades who are very, very skilled mathematicians. But the problem is, economics isn't entirely mathematical. They presume that because they can predict something with using a very complicated formula, that they've actually predicted and in actual fact, you can't.
Well, it's like inquiries into cabinet ministers, very political, actually.
Well, it is. Of course, all of these things are social, you know.
In the meantime,
there isn't just a technical fix for a problem.
Never mind. There's
usually a social and human aspect that you need to take into account.
Never mind the crimes of the Deputy Prime Minister or the crimes of the CBI. What about Rishi Sunak? He's declared his wife's share after a financial interest row this week. I mean, these are the sorts of trying to hide vested interests. Rishi Sunak has referenced his wife's shares, finally, in a childcare firm after a conflict of interest row. The PM faced questions over Akshatamurti's shares in Koru Kids, a childcare agency which has been benefiting from a policy in last month's budget. He faces a parliamentary probe after not mentioning them during a committee appearance last month, which he was supposed to mention them at. So he's got vested interests. He's trying to keep hidden under the carpet.
Well, what I was reading in The Observer, I think it was over the weekend, is that the idea that he's in power to try and make money doesn't make sense. Rishi Sunak is earning less money as a prime minister than he did doing what he did for Goldman Sachs.
Well, this is how you make money, isn't it? You make policies which help your wife out.
Yes, that's true. And of course, but what happens with prime ministers? They don't make much money while they're prime minister. They certainly make loads once they've been one. What's happened with Boris Johnson and Tony Blair?
He sounds to me more like a lobbyist than he does a prime minister who's looking out for the interests of the people
You see, if you were a Tory prime minister, look what's happened with Cameron. He was involved with Greensill, internet bank which went bust, and he expected
these
to make
deadly serious these things, aren't they? If you've got a vested interest and you're making the decision,
he was
and
lobbying
then you try and hide it, you know.
Yes, but this is what strikes me as interesting about this is that the amount of money that's involved in this is relatively small from Rishi Sunak and his wife's point of view. And if he was going to push this idea of doing whatever he's doing,
it'd be quite a lot of money if it was you or I.
Yeah, but it'd be quite a lot of money for you or I. But I'm just saying for them, it's not. And what he could have done if he was going to do this is just say to her, why don't you just sell those shares before we make the policy? But he didn't do that. And of course, it just looks bad. I mean,
When asked why he failed to declare these interests, the PM's spokeswoman said previously, they don't even name them, look at this, how pathetic they want to hide, even the spokespeople for Sunak, said previous decisions about what to include were made by past ethics advisers, and overruling them could affect future declarations made by others. So, I mean, it's obvious that if your wife's got a big shareholding in a childcare firm and you're bringing in policies that affect childcare, that you've got to declare it. It's obvious.
It is.
We're getting the same thing here in Bristol. Sorry to interrupt you, but we're in the same here in Bristol, haven't we? Where we were hearing last week from Joe Banks about some planning advisor who he's also sitting on the Planning Scrutiny Committee.
Well, this goes on all the time.
It's getting worse, man. It's getting worse.
I think what may have happened in the Rishi Sunak case is they've got massive shareholdings and all sorts of things. They probably don't even know everything that they own. You know,
I didn't know I had any interest in
I mean, what happened?
But he's just accidentally, apparently, they're getting an incentive payment of £600 for every childminder that works for these companies. That's going out now up to £1,200. So, lots of more money is appearing in our bank account. We didn't even notice.
But lots of money keeps appearing in their bank accounts. And once you are wealthy, you can literally sit back and the money will appear in your bank account.
But it's never enough, is it? It's like heroin. No. You've got to keep having more and more and more.
Yeah.
Final story before we hook up with David Hughes. After a $787.5 million Dominion settlement, what's next for Fox, says the BBC. Now, this is a big fine. It's nearly $1 billion. $750 million. Because in a lawsuit, Dominion, who make voting machines, alleged that Fox had damaged their business by spreading false claims its machines might help rig the 2020 election in Joe Biden's favour. Whilst Fox quickly declared the settlement a victory, the media empire was also forced to acknowledge that certain claims it made about Dominion were false, potentially putting it at odds with Donald Trump and vast swathes of its audience ahead of the up-and-coming 2024 election. The network, controlled by 92-year-old billionaire mogul Rupert Murdoch, must still contend with a second similar lawsuit from another voting technology firm, Smartmatic, seeking an even larger sum of $2.7 billion. Well, this could possibly destroy the Murdoch empire. But anyway, it's interesting where it's coming from. These electronic voting machine companies aren't exactly fluffy bunnies, are they?
They're not, but it would have been interesting if this had gone to court, because then we could have actually seen the evidence for vote rigging one way or the other, couldn't we? I think what's interesting about this is that Fox have settled out of court, so that evidence wasn't looked into. I understand Murdoch himself may have been forced to testify. And of course, if you contest it and lose, that looks really bad, doesn't it?
I doubt that.
I was reading that he was definitely going to potentially have to testify. I think what's interesting about this is that Murdoch is ditching Trump. He's decided. But he's decided that he's not.
I know you liked having a bash on over Trump's head, but I'm saying here is that the most interesting aspect of this story is the whole idea of electronic voting electronic voting machines. There is somebody patting them on the back, saying, "Well done for helping to destroy the network which outed the gain of function and Peter Daszak over in Wuhan." Right, to get rid of Fox News would be rather wonderful for them. Obviously, they've caused trouble for the deep state and electronic voting machines are a major part of this whole new technocracy they're trying to bring.
Indeed, but the point is, I mean, in Venezuela, for example, Tony, they have an electronic voting machines, but you also get a paper ballot as a record of what your vote was. And
do you trust electronic voting machines?
No, I don't really. You should stick...
At all? Never?
No, but I mean, if you're going to have them, you've then got to have regulations about using them, haven't you? Now, it may well be that if he'd come to court, we would have seen the evidence, supposedly, one way or the other. This out-of-court settlement means that nobody really knows what happened at all. Maybe we're not supposed to.
Anyway, hopefully now, thanks, Martin, we're joined on the line by Dr. David Hughes. David, are you there?
I am there, Tony.
Oh, hi, David. Nice to hear your voice again. We spoke to you, just to refresh listeners' memory, I think it was last autumn, about a report that you did on the evidence of unexplained materials, both in the COVID jabs themselves, this is the Pfizer, Moderna, AstraZeneca jabs, and also in people's bodies and bloodstreams after they've been jabbed. So before we talk about this paper we're going to do today, can you just give us a brief summary of that? So hopefully just to refresh people's memory who may have heard you last time.
Right, yes. Well, this was a paper that I published in September, and it summarized the findings of 26 research teams around the world that had actually conducted microscopic and spectroscopic analysis of the contents of the vials and also of the blood of vaccinated patients. And to cut a long story short, the results were quite horrifying. There were all kinds of artifacts in there that clearly shouldn't have been there, many of which look man-made. And there's speculation that some of this could, in fact, be covert technology.
Yeah, so the paper is called Evidence of a Global Crime Against Humanity. But anyway, we're looking today at a previous paper of yours, which you did mention, I think, at the time. It's taken me a little while to get around to asking you about it. The paper is called Wall Street, the Nazis, and the Crimes of the Deep State. And I wonder if you could just start by telling us a bit about why this is relevant today, you know, similarities between then and now.
Because it seems to me that there is a global attempt underway to collapse liberal democracy and replace it with a novel form of totalitarianism, which goes by the name of technocracy. Now, just as the final solution back in the days of Nazi Germany didn't happen overnight and took many years of laying the groundwork through legal, cultural and other means, it seems to me as though we are at the thin edge of the wedge here. And what I wanted to do with this paper was to draw people's attention to some of the similarities between now and then, but also to use a class analysis to explain some of those similarities.
Okay, can you run us through some of them? Because, I mean, for many, I'm a little bit suspicious about what's going on, particularly with the rise of the technocracy now. And I wonder whether, it's coming at a time where many people who can remember the Second World War, can remember the times of strife and the totalitarianism of the Hitler regime, etc., have now just passed away. And so there isn't that community memory left of it, David.
That's a very important observation. And again, just to preface this, I'm not saying that we are already in a state of full-blown totalitarianism, but I am trying to say that the warning signs are now here. So you asked about some of the parallels. Well, for example, the kind of mass psychosis that we've seen over the last few years, that the willingness of people to surrender their liberties, a kind of descent into madness almost on a mass scale. All of this was seen in Nazi Germany. The use of military-grade propaganda against the population, the use of the big lie, The idea of collectivism.
Okay, just I think we all know about the big lies from back then, but what about the big lie now?
Oh, well, the biggest one is the pandemic. And if you look at the, particularly Dennis Rancor's paper co-authored with two colleagues from 2021, where he analyzes all-cause mortality data in the United States, which is some of the most reliable data out there, he demonstrates very convincingly, in my opinion, that the pattern of deaths in the United States was not consistent with a viral pandemic. There was what he called jurisdictional heterogeneity. In other words, very high spikes in death in places like New York. Meanwhile, most of the country, nothing out of the ordinary. And we've seen this in other countries as well. So once you proceed from that hard data to the idea that actually there is no evidence of a viral pandemic behaving in the kinds of ways that you would expect epidemiologically, then the whole thing begins to unravel. And, of course, that opens the door then to looking at the PCR tests, the masks, and all of the other lies that were told in the name of
Yeah, well, sorry,
the science,
I did interrupt you asking you to talk a bit more about the big lie, but what about other parallels?
Okay, so collectivism, this idea of protecting others, we have to do things for the common good. It's worth remembering that just after the Reichstag fire, the decree for the protection of people and state was passed, more commonly known as the Reichstag's decree. But nevertheless, that same idea is there. Demonization of outgroups, spreaders of disease, of course, the Jews back then, and we had the pandemic of the unvaccinated, but it's a similar kind of logic.
I mean, so did they actually say in Nazi Germany that Jews spread diseases?
Yeah, they likened them to vermin. And, of course, that provides one of the pretexts for their extermination.
Good God. Okay.
Kevin Corbett referred back in the spring of 2020. He used the phrase the Nazification of the NHS, and he was pilloried at the time for that. But what he was talking about was the fact that health services have now been placed under a kind of command and control regime and subordinated to this new biosecurity paradigm. And I think in many ways that has been borne out, particularly with the administration of the injections. Speaking of which, approximately 5.5 billion people supposedly have now had one of these things, at least one of these things. This is a mass medical experiment carried out on humanity. Of course, no long-term safety data, inadequate trials and all the rest of it. Well, I mean, I think that's consistent with eugenics and experimentation on the human race, as were the lockdowns, the masks and the social distancing, all forms of mass experimentation. We're dealing also with issues of state-sponsored euthanasia. We saw that in this country, for example, with the Midazolam scandal, but also the MAID euthanasia program in Canada. Again, it's kind of thin edge of the wedge, but it's very disturbing when these kind of things appear. We've seen censorship. We've seen silencing of dissent, which one critic it writing in the BMJ back in 2021 said belonged firmly in the realms, quote, of a totalitarian Nazi dystopia. We've seen the undermining of parliamentary democracy and the rule of law with some very draconian provisions, not only in the Coronavirus Act, but some of the other acts and bills that have been working their way through Parliament, like the Police Crime and Sentencing Bill, the Online Safety Bill, the Covert Human Intelligence Act. I mean, these are all pernicious, really, in terms of democracy. There's the kind of the fascist fusion of the state and big business, which we're seeing in all kinds of ways. This emergency alert that's coming up on Sunday sees all of the phone companies working with the government in that regard, and that's just one example. And there's also the pushing of eco-politics and the green agenda. And again, much of that goes back to Nazi Germany. So actually, there are parallels all over the place for those who choose to look.
Well, okay. Great long list there. But what about the Nazi Greens? I've not heard about that before.
Oh, the eco-politics, the kind of the blood and soil mentality, the romanticization of the forest. In other words, in Nazi Germany, environmental discourse bled into politics and vice versa. So again, I'm not saying that what we've got here is exactly the same, but it's certainly worth taking note of the fact that the rise of green discourse and the so-called climate emergency and so on just so happens to be going hand in hand with all of these other manoeuvres, which I think are pushing in the direction of totalitarianism.
Do you want to explain why you think this is happening now, the resurgence of these Nazi themes and influences?
Yeah, so I mean, I think much of this has to do with the year 2019. And a couple of things happened in that year. First of all, there were all kinds of indicators of financial crisis. And perhaps the best one to look at is the meeting at Jackson Hole, Wyoming, of all of the leading international finance people. And that's when the going direct plan was formulated by BlackRock. And in many ways, that's the kind of the financial aspect of what we're seeing now and in the last couple of years and pushing towards central bank digital currencies and so on. But the key point is it has to do with a moment of financial crisis in which they basically realized that the old system, the old monetary order, as we've known it, at least since 1973 with the petrodollar, or you could perhaps go back further to 1945 and kind of U.S. Hegemony at the center of the system. For all intents and purposes, that paradigm is no longer fit, and we need something else. And on the other side of the ledger, in 2019, mass disenchantment with the system after more than 10 years of austerity following the 2008 financial crisis manifested itself in protests in 35 countries around the world. And we're talking mass protests here. So that's about one in five countries. So clearly huge levels of social discontent with a system which is on its last legs. And as Giorgio Agamben, the Italian philosopher, said, the paradigm of rule, the existing paradigm of rule, as had been around for a very long time, was clearly deemed to be no longer fit for purpose, and that was the moment at which they threw what Kees van der Peil calls the COVID emergency brake. And so all of what we've seen has been a kind of huge psychological operation to try and intimidate, victimize, bully, coerce, demoralize the public into accepting these very, very draconian agendas which are now in play.
Well, I must put in a plug for Kees, for someone who I remember writing about the Bilderbergers back in the 1990s, when no academics, pretty much, apart from Mike Peters up at Leeds Metropolitan University, was doing so. His book, which is out recently, is called States of Emergency, and it says pretty much exactly that, David, that the elites of the world realise that as they destroy democracy, they start to take control through from the top down, that people at the bottom will start to rise up and that they need to control that too.
That's absolutely what it's about. So, I mean, it's fundamentally a global class war, and the a minority, a small minority of humanity, who are nevertheless fabulously wealthy and own the means of production, I think they are literally going to war now against the rest of humanity in order to achieve their aim, which is the transition to global technocracy. And we should be under no illusions that global technocracy is a form of biodigital enslavement.
So how do the other big superpowers like China and Russia fit into this, or don't they?
Well, of course they do. China is what Ian Davis refers to as the world's first technate. So Rockefeller investment into China has been going on for many decades. And of course, where was the social credit system, for example, first pioneered successfully? In China. So we're seeing many of the, it's almost like a kind of a petri dish, a test ground. And now that it's been rolled out in China and it's been proven to be feasible, it would appear that that model is now intended for the West and eventually everywhere else.
And what about Russia and Ukraine?
That's a slightly separate issue. I mean, we're dealing with geopolitics rather than the previous things I've been talking about. But I mean, that's an interesting one because that's taking up a lot of attention. It's generating a lot of fear, of course. It's being used as the pretext for energy shortages, fuel price hikes, and all the rest of it. But, I mean, as John Mearsheimer predicted back in 2015, the kind of relentless NATO-EU expansion ever since the end of the Cold War, coupled with the events of 2014, would inevitably lead to conflict with Ukraine, and indeed that's what we've seen.
Yeah. Well, anyway, your paper starts with the this idea of Wall Street and the Nazis, Wall Street and the rise of Hitler.
Yeah, I mean, I draw a lot in the early stages on the work of Anthony C. Sutton from the 1970s. And this is work which has been ignored, really, for far too long. But through careful archival research, he demonstrates quite a lot of fairly astounding things in terms of Wall Street financing, both of the Soviet Union, but also of Nazi Germany. And he makes a fairly convincing case, in my opinion, that it would not have been possible for Germany to get back on its feet, to produce the kind of war machine that it did, let alone go to war, were it not for the backing of some very wealthy bankers and industrialists from the United States.
Well, it's not just the US, is it? I mean, we know that Montague Summers, Montague Norman, who was the boss of the Bank of England, and as well as our own King, Edward VIII, were very pro-Nazi. In fact, the Bank of England were very helpful to the Nazis building up their arms.
Yes, and again, we're dealing here with issues of class. And if you put yourself for a moment in the position of the ruling class, then clearly totalitarianism is a very attractive proposition because you establish total or near total control over society. It's a very effective means of crushing working class opposition. And of course, taking out the brown shirts, the working class wing, was one of the first things that Hitler did through the SS when he came to power. So it makes perfect sense that at moments such as this, when there's great instability in the system, when there's a real risk of protest becoming mass resistance and possibly spilling over into revolution, that actually the powers that be would want to manufacture this new form of totalitarianism, technocracy, in order to keep the population in check.
I mean, I think we should also add to that, with Anthony Sutton's work, the idea of the City of London and the British Royal Family and the rise of Hitler. But anyway, look, we had on this programme, must be probably 10 years ago now, and I brought him in the car down from, bless him, from Marlborough, a chap called Harry Beckoff, who worked for MI6 during the war. And after the war, he was asked to do denazification. He was actually very friendly with Winston Churchill, and this whole idea was that MI6 were going through Germany after the war, making sure that anyone that was a senior Nazi wasn't in any kind of powerful position. He went to Cologne University, and he discovered that one of the heads of politics there was actually an absolutely fanatical, diehard Nazi, and so he sent information back to the occupying forces saying, well, this guy needs to be removed from his position because he's a Nazi. We don't really want these people running the country after we leave. And actually, there was questions asked about it in the House of Commons, saying, "Oh, this man Harry Beckoff is trying to get rid of this very decent, lovely chap." And in fact, eventually, he was removed. But it shows the power the Nazis had to stop demancification when it was somebody, one of their friends, that wanted to stay in power after the war. And of course, we know also that there were quite a lot of Nazis, particularly Wehrmacht people, who were working for NATO after all. But anyway, it didn't really quite manage. I'm also thinking, David, of a chap I had a chat with when I was over in Holland doing one of my talks, which was called The Traitors of Arnhem, really about my book, but actually over in Holland, waiting for the ferry to come back to the UK in The Hague, just chatting to one of the locals, and he was saying, well, the trouble was, he was an old chap, he was saying, well, the trouble was after the war, my uncle and my parents told me that some of the people who were the collaborators with the Nazis were just straight away in Holland in charge after World War II, and they were running Holland after the end of the war. So they were wondering, well, what on earth is going on here? But anyway, it wasn't a massive success, denazification, was it, after World War II?
Certainly not. And I have a section about this in the article that we're discussing today called The Failures of Denazification. And it was US officials predominantly that were responsible for this so-called effort at denazifying. They were principally controlled by Wall Street interests. And what we find is that many of these senior Nazis and their industrialist backers evaded justice. So big names like Alfred Krupp and Friedrich Flick, they were back in their old positions as early as the 1950s. No Americans were tried in this, despite the role of Wall Street and Henry Ford and others in facilitating the rise of Hitler. The Bank of International Settlements is also quite interesting in this regard. It managed Nazi gold, and it had several Nazis on its board of directors, some of whom were involved in processing dental gold looted from the mouths of concentration camp victims. And there was a call back in 1944, the Bretton Woods Conference, that the Bank of International Settlements actually be liquidated. And as we know, that never happened. So despite its complicity with the crimes of the Third Reich, the Bank of International Settlements was able to carry on. And there were some very powerful individuals who assumed some very influential roles. So Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, for example, co-founded the Bilderberg Group. You have Walter Hallstein, first president of the EEC. Adolf Heusinger became the chairman of the NATO Military Commission. Kurt Kiesinger became West German Chancellor. Kurt Waldheim became president of Austria. I mean, all of these men were former Nazis, but nevertheless, after the war, when we start to deal with issues of global governance, denazification simply wasn't a concern.
Martin Summers, maybe we can bring you in here, because there was most definitely a flavour, wasn't there, after World War II? Even Winston Churchill famously said, Operation Unthinkable, I think it was called, that wouldn't it be wonderful, because we dislike the Soviet Union so much, maybe we could use one of these wonderful nuclear weapons and bomb Moscow with it.
Well, there's that is overwhelmingly the case. I mean, we know that happened because we've got the evidence from Freedom of Information requests subsequently. Well, I mean, the Third World War began the day the Second World War ended, didn't it?
Vincenzo Vinciguerra says that in the Gladio film by Alan Frankovich. He says 1945, World War II ended and World War III began. Well, what about this Bank of International Settlements? This is a sort of central banker's central bank, and it's quite important. If the Bretton Woods Conference said, well, this bank should be shut down because they're so powerful that they allowed Hitler to come, you know, to fund his build-up of arms, and there was nothing we could do about it. They're still very much in existence today, aren't they?
They are, and as has been said, there was talk about abolishing the Bank of International Settlements. There was talk of creating an international currency called Bancor, which wouldn't be controlled by an individual government. These were the ideas of John Maynard Keynes.
Well, of course, they were undermined. Is the IMF controlled by the United States or not?
The IMF is ultimately controlled by the United States. They have a controlling stake in it, which is exactly why the Chinese are trying to set up an alternative economic system with the Russians, because they want to break away from it all.
So, David, what do you make of the? I mean, this central banker's central bank survived, and as I understand it, that what they call the Tower of Basel. I think there is a book called The Tower of Basel about the BIS in Switzerland, in Basel. That they actually have their own jurisdiction there. They have their own police force. So even if someone is in there accused of fraud or even murder, then they have their own police force to investigate it. The Swiss police aren't even allowed in.
It says a lot, doesn't it, about where the power really lies. And of course, in a sense, it's a kind of a way of coordinating central banks internationally. But you have this international finance capital class beginning with the kind of the big investment banks, who of course are then tremendously influential over the federal banks, and then that's all in turn coordinated at a higher level by the Bank of International Settlements. I mean, really, this is where the root of so many of the problems in the world lies, in my opinion.
Yes, so there are apparently quite a lot of Nazis were headhunted after the war, and you talk about something called the Unit 731, which I hadn't heard of.
Oh, well, Unit 731, that was Japan, and it was a really vicious part of the Japanese Imperial Army. So this was performing lethal human experiments during the war. In fact, earlier than that, we're talking kind of vivisection, injecting victims with venereal diseases disguised as vaccinations, using live human targets to test grenades, flamethrowers, etc. I mean, really, really nasty stuff. After the war, some of these war criminals were granted secret immunity by the United States in exchange for their, in inverted commas, expertise. And this wasn't revealed until 1981. It wasn't formally conceded by the U.S. government until 1999. and the relevant documentation didn't come out until 2017. So when you know all of that, then you need to reappraise the history that we know of in terms of US biowarfare research, and indeed some of the biowarfare that the US deployed against North Korea. And it makes for rather an ugly picture, I'm afraid.
Okay, you also have one of your chapters entitled Wall Street, Kennan, and the Birth of the US National Security State. Well, we all know what the US National Security State is, I hope we do, but which is the deep state, effectively. And what about this? What is Kennan?
Right, so this is referring to George Kennan, who was one of the major power brokers at the time. Now, one of the points that I make in this particular section is that the national security state set up through the National Security Act of July 1947 gave birth to the whole kind of national security infrastructure that we know today, including the CIA, and that essentially this was the product of Wall Street men, William H. Jackson, Frank Wisner, Ferdinand Eberstadt, James Forrestal, William Donovan. It's very, very interesting. I mean, we're really dealing with nothing but Wall Street bankers and lawyers here. Now, Kennan was invited at the behest of James Forrestal, who was a former Dillon Reed and Company investment banker, to produce not only his famous Long Telegram of 1946, but also the famous piece that appeared in Foreign Affairs in 1947 called The Sources of Soviet Conduct. And Kennan was appointed as the inaugural director of policy planning in the US. So this is the State Department's internal think tank, if you like. So he was an extremely influential figure. Now, he tends to be remembered in kind of cliched terms as, you know, such as the kind of the godfather of containment and this kind of thing. But what I point out in my article is that actually this is a man who had profoundly fascist sympathies. So if you go back to 1938, Kennan was proposing an authoritarian form of government in the United States. He wanted to see suffrage withdrawn from what he called bewildered and ignorant women, immigrants, and African Americans. He was an admirer of the fascist regime in Austria. After the war, he was the architect of the reverse course in Japan, which reinstated pre-war political class A war criminals. He didn't want to know about Nazi war crimes when dealing with Germany. He thought that it would be better, in his words, to, quote, hold the present ruling class of Germany strictly to its task and teach it the lessons we wish to learn. Meanwhile, in Latin America, he was advocating, quote, harsh measures of repression, which, of course, we all know where that went in Latin America, eventually with Operation Condor and so on. So the point I'm making here is that even in these early Cold War years, you had key men at the heart of this, put in place by Wall Street, essentially, who had profoundly fascist sympathies.
What is the dual state?
So the dual state was a term that was used by Hans Morgenthau initially in 1955. And he drew a distinction between what he called the regular state hierarchy, which is the kind of the visible state that we all see and are familiar with, but also a security hierarchy as well. And the security hierarchy kind of operates in the background. So the regular hierarchy, it's visible, it obeys the rule of law and so on. But the security hierarchy in the background monitors and controls that regular hierarchy and is capable of exercising veto power over it, often in terms of emergency measures taken in the name of security. So Ola Tunander wrote some really interesting stuff about this, and you can link it, of course, to ideas previously about the invisible government. But when we get into the kind of age of security in the early 1950s or even late 1940s, we are talking NATO, of course. And what Tunander argues is that with an organization like NATO, even though you seem to have lots of separate countries, each with their own kind of security organizations, in actual fact, the whole thing is what he calls a kind of a U.S. Superstate. And actually, the U.S., perhaps you might want to say Anglo-American intelligence, kind of has this kind of oversight of the whole thing and is capable of stepping in and exercising veto power at any moment. And that ultimately was what led into, for instance, the Gladio stay behind armies, which were run by NATO. And you mentioned Vince Aguirre, and of course all of that stuff really came to the fore in the 1970s. So, in other words, a lot of this has only come to light in relatively recent years. But when you take it back, you can find that there are these kind of hidden power structures and arrangements in place right from the very beginning of the post-World War II or early Cold War period. And actually, much of what we've seen over the last few decades are these power structures becoming ever more visible, to the point where with COVID, for those who are willing to look and investigate, they're really quite obvious.
You do get the idea that there's this sort of Jimmy Savile mentality amongst some of these people, that they think, well, so long as I can get away with it until I die, then it's all right. And they obviously don't seem to have any interest whatsoever in leaving a decent legacy to their names.
Absolutely. And it goes back to the criminal dimension of a lot of this, in fact. And you know, if you look at Whitney Webb's recent work in relation to Epstein, but that's just one part of the picture. She actually traces it all the way back to the kind of era that I'm talking about, and you know, the influence of the mafia and so on. And she reaches the conclusion that today, ultimately, it's the criminals who are in charge, and I find it hard to disagree.
No, me too. Now, you know, this is something the deep state we associate with the United States, but it's not just, is it? It's now spread, certainly mostly across the West, certainly with connections into China too. Obviously, you know, maybe at a different level than over here. But how's it? The mechanism by which it's become something transnational now. We know about, you know, the ending of exchange controls here by Margaret Thatcher at the beginning of the 1980s. I was just commenting the other week that this was the first thing she did in order to make sure that money can flow all over the world, and you know, that foreign companies can buy up your infrastructure if they wish once it's been privatized. But it is something that is now transnational, isn't it, the deep state?
Yeah, and I have to wonder if it hasn't been that way really since 1947 or not long afterwards. We're dealing here primarily with intelligence agencies, although of course, you know, in partnership with, you know, banks and major corporations and so on. But if you think about the Five Eyes system, I mean, this goes back to 1946. We still use the term Five Eyes as though there's only five members of it. But what you actually find is that already as early as 1948, Canada was invited to join, Norway in 1952, Denmark in 1954, West Germany, Australia, New Zealand came in 1955. So, in other words, these intelligence operations and organizations were already becoming transnational from a very early point. And the Gladio operation, that was centered on Italy, but you know, there were similar operations all over Europe, and this was coordinated by NATO in an obviously transnational manner. So the kind of false flag terrorist attacks that it carried out, I mean, you know, we're talking Italy, Spain, Germany, France, Turkey, Greece, all over the place. These events went off, particularly after 1968, were then blamed on communist organizations. And it was a means, essentially, of crippling the West. And it's very interesting. If I could just read a quote by Vince Aguirre, seeing as you mentioned him. In 1984, he testified in court. He said this, quote, "You had to attack civilians, the people, women, children, innocent people, unknown people, far removed from any political game. The reason was quite simple. They were supposed to force these people, the Italian public, to turn to the state to ask for greater security. That was precisely the role of the right in Italy. It placed itself at the service of the state, which created a strategy aptly called the strategy of tension, insofar as they had to get ordinary people to accept that at any moment over a period of 30 years, from 1960 to the mid-1980s, a state of emergency could be declared. So people would willingly trade part of their freedom for the security of being able to walk the streets or go on trains or enter a bank. This is the political logic behind all the bombings. They remain unpunished because the state cannot condemn itself. Now, I find this a remarkable quote because, in a sense, that describes really rather accurately the logic of the war on terror after 9/11. And so you can see how these operations were kind of almost tried and tested back in the 70s and 80s and then rolled out on a global scale in the 21st century.
Well, I hope you'll have your phone. You'll be on Sunday at 3 p.m. You'll be poised by your phone, ready to obey whatever command comes down there, David.
Well, I'm afraid I'm not dumb enough to have a smartphone. I've got my old Nokia, and I don't think it will affect me.
Well, and even so, like I was saying earlier, we do have a link up on our show page, we will have tonight anyway, to how to switch these things off before it happens. But anyway, of course, you know, the fact of the matter is this, as you connect up to the internet, it connects up to you. And as you have your phone on a network, the network is listening to you and can listen to you whenever it wishes. I was, just as an anecdote, around a friend's place a few months ago, and she picked up her phone and said, well, what's this? And everything we've been discussing over the previous couple of minutes was typed out on her phone. It had been just writing it on her phone. So that's the way things work, folks. Anyway, what about the Cold War popping up again?
Well, I mean, in light of all of this emergent knowledge now about the deep state, one of the things I argue in the article is that we really need to reappraise the history of the Cold War and some of the main narratives that are told. So if you go back to Kennan's long telegram or The Sources of Soviet Conduct, his 1947 article, you get this image of the Soviet Union as this kind of implacable foe, this existential threat. And it comes through again in NSC 68, 1950 security document, primarily authored by Paul Nitzer, who again was a former vice president of Dillon Reed & Co. And the idea is always that the Soviet Union possesses this kind of overwhelming civilization-ending threat. Well, we now know that that was radically overblown, and that whole discourse essentially provided a pretext for US imperialism. And so you can go back and actually look at US-Russian relations even before World War II and find that they're remarkably cozy in certain ways. I mean, one interesting anecdote that Sutton has is that there's a single address, 120 Broadway in New York, which housed not only the first Bolshevik ambassador to the US, but also the Bankers Club, directors of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, the American International Corporation. They were literally sharing the same address. The Harriman family had longstanding close ties with the Kremlin. And even towards the end of World War II and after World War II, contrary to this narrative of total enmity between the US and the Soviet Union, what you find is, for example, Churchill's percentage notes at the Fourth Moscow Conference in 1944, which essentially Stalin kind of agreed on straight away. And the idea was that he wouldn't interfere with the post-war restabilization of capitalism in Western Europe in exchange for being able to keep control over Eastern Europe. So there was already that kind of understanding. And then after World War II, the Soviet Union was actually heavily reliant on US financial support and actually expected to receive that support as a moral right because of what it did to defeat the Nazis. So I won't go into it all here. Listeners can read it for themselves in the article, but I kind of trace this history right through the Cold War era and show that there are actually some fundamental areas of collaboration between the US and the USSR. One of the key ones, of course, is suppressing class conflict. So it's very telling that when there were major working class uprisings in East Germany in 1953 and Hungary in 1956, this would have been an ideal opportunity for the West to put real pressure on the Soviet Union. And it didn't. And in actual fact, from that moment on, Radio Free Europe and the Voice of America never again called on Eastern Europeans to revolt. So you can see that the two sides were fundamentally in cahoots when it came to suppressing the international working class. Now, obviously, they had their differences as well. Obviously, geopolitical tensions are real. But what I'm arguing is that at an even more fundamental level, the level of class, there's a basic collaboration and cooperation there.
Yeah, I think in a way you're right about some of the things that are going on behind this geopolitics in the past. We're now only just now realising some of these things that happened. I can remember interviewing John Loftus a couple of years ago. I think it was called The Secret War on the Jews, is the title of his book. But he made it clear that when the State of Israel was being created back in the 1940s, that Nelson Rockefeller, who was delivering the South American and other votes at the United Nations for the Israelis, said to their Prime Minister-to-be, Ben Gurion, you can have vengeance against the Nazis or a state, but not both, because quite a lot of the powerful financial interests in South America were Nazi interests. And so, you know, if you promise that there's not going to be any vengeance against the Nazis, then you can have their votes and you'll get their votes. And they did.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really have a comment on that, but just to note that the Rockefeller influence, as always, is there.
Yep, certainly is. Okay, so intelligence crimes, because a lot of this, what you're talking about, is relating to the intelligence services, they like to call themselves, but in a way, maybe they're intelligence criminals.
Yes, indeed. Intelligence crime is a concept that I've taken from Willem de Lint in his recent book. And we're dealing here with crimes that, well, they take place in different ways and on varying scales, but some of them take place on a scale which almost defies comprehension. You know, killing so many people or staging acts of such spectacular terrorism. But at the same time, somehow they kind of remain invisible because of propaganda. They remain unpunished because the perpetrators stand above the law. And in particular, they remain underanalyzed by academics, which is my major concern here. So the section I have on intelligence crime traces the influence of the CIA in particular through the history of post-1945 US foreign policy right the way through to the present day. And unfortunately, it makes for a very long and grim list of coups, covert operations, reverse waves of democratization in Latin America, biowarfare techniques during the Korean War, the 1965 coup in Indonesia, where somewhere between 1 and 2 million people lost their lives, Operation Phoenix in Vietnam, again, mass murder of innocent civilians. On and on and on it goes. I mean, I talk about Rwanda and Turkey and Iraq in the 1990s. It's extremely grim. And again, I think people need to be aware of just how much evil, how much you know, really serious mass atrocity has taken place at the hands of this deep state, because that's what we're faced with now. That's what we're dealing with. And one of the points I make is that a lot of this was directed against foreign populations in the 20th century. After 9/11, the focus started to turn more on domestic populations, not necessarily in terms of the mass atrocity yet, but in terms of putting together the architecture for oppression and moving societies ever more in an authoritarian direction, ever further away from liberal democracy. And when you can understand that historical arc, and then you look at the mass atrocities that have taken place during the COVID era, again, it signals a clear and present danger to me that we are now, again, looking potentially here at the thin edge of a move to totalitarianism on a worldwide scale.
Well, let's hope not. What do you put that down to? I mean, this is a big question you're asking here. Why is it that the mass media fails to address some of the biggest crimes, as you called crimes against humanity, going on in the world today? And not just that, our education system and academia doesn't want to know.
Yeah, again, I mean, well, this has been going on for over a century, really. And again, you can trace it back to the Rockefeller Foundation, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
But what's going on in the mindset of the individual, you know, lecturers, teachers, journalists who should be tackling this, editors? I suppose I'm trying to get at here, do you think it's a structural thing that they just cannot do it? Or is it that they're turning their heads away from this?
I think there will be some who are turning their heads away, but I think many genuinely don't understand what is happening, or wouldn't believe it if you told it to them and provided the evidence. It's the whole cognitive dissonance thing. I think in our previous conversation, I highlighted the role of funding in academia, and you know, a lot of good research gets done that's funded. But of course, what it does mean is that because the funders are very rich, powerful organizations, they have no interest in funding anything which will fundamentally challenge the status quo. And so that kind of work doesn't get done, because in order to become an academic, you have to win funding. In order to get promotion, you have to win funding. The whole system has become tied to money. And in that very kind of neoliberal corporate capitalist setup, it's obvious why you're not going to get any really, really critical analysis of the system itself. And I guess the same is going to be true in journalism. I'm minded of Noam Chomsky's interview with Andrew Marr decades ago, when Andrew Marr says to Chomsky, look, I'm, you know, are you telling me that I can't, you know, think for myself? You know, I'm very kind of obstreperous, you know, I won't be told what to do, you know, ask the questions I want. And Chomsky smiles back wryly and says, well, I'm sure you do, and I'm sure you believe every word that you're saying. But the point is, if you did think anything different, you wouldn't be sitting in that chair. So the system selects the very kind of people who, by their very nature, for whatever reason, are happy to go along with it. So it does lead us, you know, it's a very difficult area. It's what Gramsci referred to as hegemony, a kind of form of cultural control through the media, through education, through religious establishments as well. Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, Martin Summers, this is a frog boiling moment, isn't it, really? I mean, slowly but surely, in education and academia particularly, the various avenues of research have become slowly but surely privately funded. I mean, we had on here a discussion, Is Science Dead?, with doctors Chris Exley and Chris Busby. Chris Exley lost his job at Keele University because he was looking into the effects, negative effects potentially, of aluminium in vaccines. And yes, then he was told, no, don't, you're not allowed to actually be part of this university anymore, and we're not going to allow you to even do private fundraising to do research at this university. So, Martin, what is going on here? Slowly but surely, we've seen a complete shifting of academia, and actually with the BBC, I suppose, to a lesser extent, from the government funding over to private funding for all of this.
Well, there's been a privatisation process, for sure. But I think, as we've heard, this has been going on for a long time. It's coming to a head. We certainly are in an inflection point with all of this. But it's been going on for a long time. And it amazes me why people, you know, the world has always been like this. It's never been better than this, and it's now worse than it has been.
Wasn't it better after the Second World War?
Well, after the Second World War, there was a brief moment in the West where, because of the existence of an alternative system in Russia and China, and China was regarded as a bit of a joke at the time, you know, nobody took them seriously, and then they went off on with the Cultural Revolution and the Great Leap Forward and so on, and sort of didn't really have much of an influence outside China, apart from on third world revolutionary groups like Zandler in Zimbabwe. But the turning point is 9/11 on one level. And of course, that came in after the dot-com bubble had burst, and they didn't. We didn't used to believe in bailing out markets, but after the dot-com bubble burst, then 9/11 came along, and they suddenly bailed the markets out, and so this began the money printing process. 2019 was a very big turning point, as has been suggested. In September 2019, the repo market in the US collapsed, but we didn't find out till later on, and that's when BlackRock and Vanguard took over, and basically took over the Federal Reserve. Well, so they were deciding which financial companies live and die, and they don't even say on what criteria they did. And of course, they're basically bailing themselves out. And then, of course, the plandemic kicks in. Where I differ from the analysis that I've heard is that I think that the plandemic is in fact a biological warfare attack, and the vaccines and all the rest of it. I'm on this. Many people in Russia. China have not been given big pharma vaccines. And I think they've worked out what's going on. Kirillov, who's the head of the biological warfare troops in Russia, has basically said, look, we've captured all these biological warfare labs, and they went to the UN with it. And, of course, the British and the Americans vetoed any discussion on it.
Yeah. Art was asking about, Martin, though, was the idea of public knowledge, really, and research. That is, the research institutions in our universities and in our mass media now seem to basically be hijacked.
Well, they always were, to some extent, is the answer that I would give to that. They've been more hijacked. It's very much more difficult to be an independent academic than it used to be. I mean, once you had tenure at one stage, they couldn't get rid of you, but we've just seen what's happened to David Miller here in Bristol, where without, even though there was an internal disciplinary carried out and there was no evidence of anti-Semitism whatsoever, he's been removed. That used to be unthinkable. Not unthinkable now, is it?
No, not unthinkable with Tony Danker or Dominic Raab either. Anyway, look, you were... one of the things that you talk about in your article, David, is this whole idea of false flag terrorism. How do you link that happening now back to the Nazi era?
Well, I mean, the burning of the Reichstag Dome and blaming it on communists, of course, is a precursor for some of the false flag terrorism that was committed under the Gladio operation in the 1970s and 1980s, and as I've suggested, that in turn laid the blueprint for the so-called war on terror. And I think when you put all of this in context, as I do in my article, it becomes very difficult to look at 9/11 as anything but a false flag attack when you know how these intelligence agencies work.
Well, for anyone that may be questioning what is this whole term false flag, isn't it, Martin, to do with naval warfare in the old days?
Initially, when in the days of sailing ships and before modern communications, people would communicate by flags when they're at sea. So a false flag attack is where you creep up on the enemy flying a friendly flag, and then you get right up close to them, and then you switch the flags over and you attack them. And Cochrane, if many people have watched the film Master and Commander, he was very famous for carrying out these kind of attacks. And that's
you'd be flying a flag which would say, oh, yeah, we're your friends, we've come to give you some ammunition or something. As the boats come alongside, then a whole load of Marines will charge over and take over the ship.
If you think of the San Nazar raid in World War II, the Royal Navy steamed towards the boatyard where the U-boats were based, and they were all flying German flags. And, of course, as soon as they got there, they took them down and carried out the operation.
And in the modern terrorist context?
In the modern terrorist context, which is more to the point, really, is the idea that the state carries out terrorist attacks, and then it blames patsies, or it blames somebody, some third party, in order to control the population. And the evidence for all of this stuff is overwhelming, as we've just been hearing. And of course, there was Imposimato, who is the head of the Italian Supreme Court until recently. He wrote a book that came out in 2012, La Repubblica dei Stragi Impuni, The Republic of the Unpunished Massacres, based on decades of police investigation in Italy, which proved beyond any doubt to anybody who's looking at it that this was all carried out by the state.
But I mean, if we go back just a few years to the 7/7 attacks, there's a lot of evidence that this was also a false flag attack, that the guys who were blamed for it That they were possibly lured to London on another pretext and then basically fitted up, set up. Another thing, another example of that might be Sirhan and the assassination of RFK being hypnotised and told, you know, go there, take your gun, and someone else maybe killed RFK, and then he was caught red-handed with the gun that supposedly had done the killing. But the idea really is to just say it's almost like theatre. Really, what you're doing is you're creating an event which you spin as one side, the enemy, where actually you've done it yourself. Anyway, look, what about the global strategy of tension in this century, the 21st century now, David?
Well, it's interesting that you touch on 7/7, because as Martin says, actually, there seems to be a lot of evidence that many of these attacks actually are not what we were told. And, of course, it all gets very murky and a lot of it's very difficult to prove. And as soon as you dare to suggest it, you get jumped on and, you know, hit pieces and, you know, smears and all kinds of things.
Yeah, well, yes, exactly. By, for example, the guy that runs the Centre for Investigative Journalism, I mean, he did a bit of a hatchet job on me after I suggested there might be something to investigate about 7/7, you know. So, yes, yeah. There is...
I mean, this is exactly
a reluctance, isn't there? There's a reluctance to look at these things.
Yeah, and that's called flack. You know, they send it your way in order not only to discourage you from looking into it, but to discourage others as well. So I tried to keep this as kind of academic as I could in the paper. And I went back to the book you mentioned earlier, States of Emergency by Van der Pael. And there's an interesting passage there on pages 63, 64, and he talks about the Charlie Hebdo attack in France. And he calls it, in his words, quote, a possible false flag operation intended to force President François Hollande to change course and instill fear in French society. So this came just after the socialist majority in parliament had voted in favor of recognizing an independent state of Palestine, and just after Hollande had spoken out against sanctions on Russia over Ukraine. So, you know, not towing the line, and then shortly afterwards you have this terrorist attack. But it was the first of many, because there was then the Nice truck attack, the Normandy church attack, the Louvre knife attack, the Champs-Élysées attack, the Strasbourg attack. And so France has been a real kind of inflection point, as it were, for a lot of this. And it almost seems that the greater the social tensions, the greater the protests, the more recourse there is to these kinds of very, to the dark arts, these nefarious acts of terror, in order to push the society more in the direction of a police state. So what did we see in France as a result of these attacks? 10,000 troops deployed on French streets under the Sentinel anti-terrorism operation. This is very much in line with what Vinci Guerra was talking about in the Gladio context. And of course, it wasn't just France. You know, there was a real period of intensification, I argue in the piece, between 2015 and 2017. And we saw the Brussels bombings, Berlin Christmas market attack, Westminster Bridge, Stockholm, Manchester Arena, London Bridge, Finsbury Park Mosque, etc., etc. And it's really interesting because it seems as though if that were the strategy, it didn't work. Because in France, the yellow vests, you know, kind of exploded and were taking to the streets weekend after weekend after weekend for well over a year. And it's almost as though, you know, in that context where this strategy is no longer working, that's one of the factors which eventually kind of caused this kind of COVID emergency break, again, to use Van der Pael's term.
Also, the closer that Jeremy Corbyn got to power, we saw more terrorist attacks here in Britain, didn't we? With the Manchester Arena, you mentioned there, London Bridge and Westminster. Maybe a correlation there, David.
Yeah, quite possibly. And, I mean, what troubles me is that if you are intellectually honest enough to actually look at the evidence, very often the evidence does seem to give serious cause for concern. And I find it deeply frustrating that academics just refuse to look at the evidence. I mean, at the moment, you know, for instance, think about the Manchester arena attack. I mean, Richard D. Hall is coming under all kinds of flack for that from the BBC and, you know, from victims' families.
To be fair, from me as well, for saying that the victims' families are lying when they say that they've lost a loved one. I mean, this is a very, very serious charge to make.
Yeah. So what I was going to say was, you know, you can certainly question the ways he went about some of this. However, if you actually just look at some of the evidence that he presents in the findings, some of it is quite hard to argue against. So that does trouble me. And
this is a propaganda technique, potentially, isn't it? That you bring up some genuine concerns and mix them with fake concerns, which are likely to literally very unethical journalism, where you're accusing the victims of actually being perpetrators of an attack. I mean, that's obviously absolutely unacceptable.
Well, I'm just more concerned in the evidence, really. And my point is simply that when you just focus on the evidence, oftentimes it's quite strong. But again, there are strong mechanisms in place to deter people from actually, you know, doing an open and honest appraisal of the evidence. So I just kind of try to step back and, you know, look at these attacks in the aggregate, you know, without making any judgment on any individual attack, you know, was it or was it not a false flag attack, and just demonstrate that actually collectively they fit a pattern. And what's very, very interesting about this is from 2020, when there's this paradigm shift from the war on terror to biosecurity, all of a sudden the terrorist attacks largely dry up, you know, not completely, but compared to how frequently they had been taking place, a dramatic reduction. And again, you have to ask questions, why would that be?
Well, you do, and certainly why would it be that the COVID scare seemed to absolutely vanish almost the minute that the Russian troops went into the Donbass and started fighting Ukraine?
Right. So, you know, what this tells you is that very often we are dealing with phony narratives which are being pushed out in a very carefully coordinated manner transnationally. And it's through that coordination that their power becomes so great that so many people buy into them. It becomes possible to kind of, you know, drive the population to in whatever direction you like. And again, it's interesting just to go back to the Nazis, but in 1946, the psychologist Carl Jung was reflecting about the mass psychosis that he'd witnessed in Nazi Germany. And he uses phrases like, you know, it became possible for the psychopaths, he actually calls the leaders psychopaths, to drive what he calls the hypnotized sheep, meaning the people, in whatever direction they liked. And the end result of that was World War II and the Holocaust. And what bothers me, and I and my co-authors make this claim in our two recent pieces criticizing Matthias Desmet's work, what bothers me about this is we're seeing a similar kind of pattern now where, you know, for 2 years, everything is COVID, 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 and that's all the population can think about. And then almost overnight, in kind of January, February 2022, that suddenly switched off and mostly goes away, still rumbling on in the background. But then all of a sudden, everything is Russia-Ukraine, and these Ukraine flags are flying all over the place. And it, to me, it's just an extraordinary demonstration of the power of propaganda and psychological warfare, just to be able to get people to go in whatever direction you like. And it's really quite terrifying, and the historical precedent indicates that it's also extremely dangerous.
Is there an argument, do you think, for throwing your computer out the window and putting a brick through your television?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, well, I certainly don't have a smartphone. I mean, maybe, you know, without going that far necessarily. What we need to realise is that, you know, we didn't get very much into technocracy, but it is all about the technocratic control grid. And obviously the internet is a key part of that. It may be that they have other kind of EMF ways of enabling that grid as well. But people sometimes say, you know, what can we do to challenge what's going on? And Simon Elmer, you know, he has an interesting take on this. He says, well, you know, at the individual level, of course, there's non-compliance. At the group level, there's civic disobedience. But one very practical measure, which really could put a massive dent in all of this, is if everybody were to get rid of their smartphone. Because so much of this relies on the smartphone, not just the conditioning, but, you know, the QR codes and the way they were pushing towards the kind of health passes and all the rest of it. And Klaus Schwab and Thierry Malloré write in their book about how this is kind of due to go under the skin in due course. So, you know, most people carry these devices around. They're inseparable from them. They sleep next to them, etc. Well, all this is doing is hooking human beings up to this technocratic control grid. And again, this is where I have deep concerns about the actual contents of the injections. You know, does this feed into it as well? So, yes, I think there's a really, really strong case, actually, for ditching the smartphones. But the trouble is, about 99.9% of the population is literally addicted to them. They literally can't do it.
Well, yes, I was going to say, it's a forlorn hope. If you ever, like, literally, you know, half the people, particularly young ones, walking down the street are staring into their smartphone. It's connected into their ear. If you were to say, excuse me, then they probably wouldn't hear you. They walk straight past. And often you see even couples sitting down together, neither of them speaking to each other, both of them on their phones. But look, I think one of the most important final section in your article is about Nazis or descendants of Nazis, siblings or whatever. No, actually, kids of Nazis, I suppose, in positions of power today, David.
Right. So it's not just that there are kind of structural and class factors which explain you know, some of the Nazi features resurfacing today. That I described at the beginning of the interview today. There's actually, in some cases, actual family lineages as well. And I just mentioned a few of them towards the end of my article. I mean, the really obvious one, of course, is Klaus Schwab. His father, Eugen Schwab, was the managing director of a company called Escherwiss, and this was granted special status by the Nazis, permitting slave labor. So that's his heritage, and of course we know what he's doing today. You know, he openly boasts that his young global leaders have penetrated the cabinets of multiple countries. Again, just, you know, stop and reflect on that, the crisis of liberal democracy at the moment, and we have this guy whose father was very well placed with the Hitler regime, openly boasting about penetrating the cabinets.
I mean, it's worth saying something about these Nazi companies, because this was something that happened in the 1930s in Germany, is the Nazification and the SSification of many companies, that they would become Nazified. They would have swastika flags outside the company and around the railings, etc., pictures of Hitler down the corridors. And, of course, the most supreme accolade, and Schwab's company seems to have had that, is that the SS would deliver them workers, and they would pay something like 5 marks a day per worker as a slave in their factories.
That's correct. Again, it's this fusion of the state and big business.
Yeah, because I think, David, there's quite a lot of people, Andrew Neil's one of them, who sort of excuses this and say, well, you know, you had to be a Nazi, but many people were Nazis, but they weren't really into, you know, this cult of Hitler and the SS and that kind of thing. Well, I'm afraid if you're taking slave labor from the SS, then you are part of it.
Yeah, and you know, the Schwabs are not the only ones. I talk about the Kvant family as well, tremendously wealthy family in Germany. But they set up what one critic described as a company-owned concentration camp, their words, not mine, where workers were told upon arrival that they would no longer live, that they would not live longer than 6 months on account of exposure to poisonous gases. So if that account is true, again, that's the caliber that we're looking at here with the Kvant family. They also had very close ties to Goebbels and to Hitler. And what you find when you look at the descendants is that Johanna Kvant's granddaughter was you know, one of the wealthiest women in Germany. And she's been throwing money at the Charité Foundation in Berlin, major hospital there. So she's involved in funding healthcare. Her grandfather was a director of the Institute for Hygiene at Friedrich Wilhelm University, which is where a lot of the Nazi eugenics experiments took place.
Well, you're talking here about the Quants, I think, is I mean, certainly how it's pronounced here in the UK.
Sorry, I've got the German pronunciation.
Yeah, the Quants. Quants. And it's funny because I noticed Mary Quant died last week, I think it was. This family that were major battery manufacturers for the Nazi regime. And as you say, you know, they, certainly after the war, were sort of rehabilitated really by the West. And they said, oh, well, these people are really cool and quite quaint. And they took I think it was a big stake in the BMW company. And if anyone is interested in looking further into this and, you know, thinks that we're a couple of conspiracy theorists, well, we're most definitely not. There is a terrific documentary called The Silence of the Quants, which caused an absolute sensation in Germany because the journalists in Germany put this documentary together because the Quants were completely in denial, and in a way which is rather worrying, particularly in our own royal circles, in denial about answering very basic questions such as, you know, are you going to have a multi-faith service at the coronation, or are you going to be the head of the Church of England, or are you going to be the head of multi-faiths? You know, I think we just need to make sure that our leaders and our civic and our industrial leaders are there to answer these basic simple questions. But anyway, back to the Quants.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting that you bring up that documentary. That's actually the source of the quote that I gave a few minutes ago. But I mean, there are other families as well. David de Jong recently published a book called Nazi Billionaires, and he goes through the Flick family, the von Finck family, the Porsche family, the Oetke family. All of these families, you know, very, very wealthy, former ties to the National Socialist regime. And we mustn't overlook all of this. These are very real lineages. And the one final example I give has to do with Canada, actually, and Chrystia Freeland, who, of course, Deputy Prime Minister of Canada. She sits on the World Economic Forum Board of Trustees. But it emerged recently that her grandfather, Michael Chomiak, was a Ukrainian Nazi collaborator. So, again, it's not automatically to say that she must hold these sympathies herself, but she did tweet a picture of herself holding a red and black flag associated with the Bandera movement. And, you know, when that was pointed out, she deleted it without comment. So, unfortunately, the kind of the end result here is that although we would like to think that the Nazis and what they stood for were kind of dead and buried in 1945, unfortunately, their influence is more than alive today.
Well, I mean, my own evidence seems to have dug out links to Martin Bormann, particularly between Martin Bormann, Hitler's private secretary, and Desmond Morton, Winston Churchill's private secretary, and the mass laundering of the Nazi wealth from Switzerland and South America through the Sullivan and Cromwell, the Dulles Brothers law firm, in New York to create a kind of financial Fourth Reich. Do you think that's fair?
I don't know. I don't know enough about that. I'd be interested to look into that.
Well, I have to send you the book. And also, when it comes to the technocracy, this is something that's very difficult, I think, for some people to understand. And what do you make of this whole business of accelerationism, which is apparently, according to David Livingstone anyway, my old school friend, I mean, he was a school friend, Nick Land, has put together. What do you make of accelerationism and its link to the way that things are changing right now?
Well, I don't know that much about it. And from what I do know, it's quite a broad church, so I don't want to kind of caricature it. But the idea seems to be that it's all about there is no kind of alternative to the current system. Yes, it may be bad, but we need to speed up, accelerate technological developments as much as we can in an attempt to kind of push past the existing system. And it might involve destroying the existing system, but ultimately we have to get beyond it. Now, I mean, it strikes me that this is just the latest instantiation of a kind of secular millennialism almost, that, you know, these images, these ideas come up again and again in history, that we have to somehow kind of transcend our kind of fallen human state, and even if that involves destroying everything that we know and just, you know, destroying society and rebuilding, and of course, you know, Build Back Better comes into all of that. I mean, as far as Nick Land goes, I feel sorry for him. I mean, the guy seems demoralized, you know, very defeatist kind of position that he holds, you know, as part of a cult, you know, doing loads of drugs and had a mental breakdown. So, you know, that's not the kind of character whose views that I would take particularly seriously.
No, but I mean, a lot of this does seem to actually be transpiring, doesn't it? The idea that, you know, that humanity may become literally slaves to artificial intelligence.
Yeah, and what goes missing from a lot of this, again, is class. And, you know, you see a similar kind of vision in transhumanism and, you know, Ray Kurzweil's idea of the singularity. I mean, that very much seems compatible with this idea of kind of acceleration, technological progress getting faster and faster and faster and faster and faster. But of course, transhumanism is just the latest form of eugenics. And what a lot of this hides is an attempt by the ruling class essentially to enslave everybody else. I mean, it's interesting, the piece you sent me on Land, he's very early on in there, he actually uses a Marxist term. He says, I'm interested in liberation of the means of production. You know, not liberation of the working classes, not liberation of the people or of humanity. No, liberation of the means of production. A very, very strange phrase. And it reminded me a little bit of James Burnham, the former Trotskyite in the 1940s. And he gave up completely on Marxism. And the instant he did, he swung violently in the opposite direction and became, you know, one of the most ardent advocates of U.S. imperialism. And so there seems to be some of that in this Nick Land character, in my opinion, that, you know, it's a very despairing kind of worldview that he's got. And, you know, as the article you sent me notes, you know, it's laced with kind of racism and eugenics and all kinds of unpleasant themes.
Well,
so
you're giving me flashbacks to the summer of 1978, where we all went off on our summer holidays with Nick the Nazi, and when we came back after the summer holidays, Nick had become a communist. So anyway, your paper is Wall Street, the Nazis and the Crimes of the Deep State, Dr. David Hughes, by Dr. David Hughes. Actually, you calling it an article. It's me that's calling it a paper. Is it fully referenced?
Yeah, it's fully referenced, absolutely.
Good. Okay, well, that's the sort of article I like. How can people follow your work then, David?
Best place is academia.edu, and just do a search for me that way. So whenever I put out a new piece or a new interview or whatever, I tend to post it on there.
And what about books? Got any books out?
One is forthcoming. I'm about to submit the manuscript for it, called COVID-19 Psychological Warfare and the Bid for Technocracy. And it's all about the psychological warfare techniques that have been deployed against the population for the last few years in a bid to effect this transition to technocracy.
Particularly on the plandemic, have you got any particular books you think that maybe people may not have heard of that you could recommend?
Gosh, I mean, where to begin? Ian Davis's Pseudo-Pandemic, I think, is right up there. Van der Peil's States of Emergency, we have mentioned already. Kennedy's Real Anthony Fauci, I think, is pretty important.
Well, look, hang on. What do you make of his presidential bid?
Oh, well, I mean, it could be anything, couldn't it? I'm torn when it comes to Kennedy. So on the one hand, I think that Children's Health Defence has done so much great work that I don't want to take anything away from him. I mean, it's so important. But on the other hand, as far as I understand it, he is part of the kind of the climate change push, which I'm personally very sceptical of. And of course, you know, ultimately he is a Kennedy, and you know, can you trust any kind of major political establishment?
Ultimately, he's likely to have his head blown off, isn't he?
That's one possibility, but I also wonder: is this now the kind of, you know, a Democrat version of Trump, in a sense? You know, a person where you can get huge numbers of voters behind him, and it kind of takes you know, a lot of their kind of frustrations away, you know, thinking they've got this guy fighting for them, and maybe he genuinely does want to. But as we saw with Trump, you know, no sooner is he in office than it all turns out to be a lot of hot air.
Well, it sounds like Biden's got your vote, David.
No one gets my vote.
Okay. And you can't vote in US elections anyway.
Well, we know that, Martin. Yeah, we know. Anyway, look, Dr. David Hughes from Lincoln University, thanks ever so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
So, fascinating stuff, I think, Martin. And, you know, making all these connections with the Nazis is the sort of thing we've been our bread and butter for the last, what, 13, 14 years.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot I agreed with there. I don't share the analysis of the plandemic, but there we go. There's bound to be differences of opinion about all sorts of things.
I mean,
isn't
in the real world of stuff that's happening, well, I say the real world, it's not, is it, the mass media, we've had Secretary General of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, this week over in Kyiv, and again speaking yesterday, I think it was in Ramstein in Germany, may even have been today, about Ukraine.
I said in Kyiv yesterday that Ukraine's future is in the Euro-Atlantic family, and all NATO allies have agreed that Ukraine will become a NATO member. But the main focus now is, of course, on how to ensure that Ukraine prevails. What we do know is that our support helps Ukraine move toward the Euro-Atlantic integration, and our support help them to make this possible. But the main focus now is on ensuring that President Putin does not win the war, that Ukraine prevails, because without a sovereign, independent Ukraine, there is no meaning in discussing membership.
Well, it's delusionary, isn't it? I mean.
No, because he's announcing there that Ukraine will become a NATO member.
But they have to win the war first, and that ain't going to happen. And in fact, the Americans are opposed to NATO, Ukraine becoming part of NATO, because they're
having to win the war. Maybe they will become a member of NATO before they win the war. That's one of the things we were hearing Rishi Sunak speaking about.
That's what
there
Kiev
is a NATO
wants.
Conference coming up. Well, I think it's potentially it's what Rishi Sunak wants. It's what it may be what Jens Stoltenberg. When this NATO meeting is coming up in July in Vilnius, is it Latvia? Vilnius, Lithuania. That's one of the things they want to change the charter to allow a country that's actually got border disputes and at war to join NATO.
Well, it may be that they will pull that rabbit out of a hat. I mean, anything can happen in a situation like this. Think about the run-up to World War One. All sorts of billiard balls careered into all sorts of other billiard balls. But, of course, the implication of Ukraine being brought into NATO sooner, like now, rather than later, is that we are going to war with Russia. That's what it means. Britain must go to war with Russia if Ukraine is in NATO. Well, there's no option to.
At least Dominic Raab won't be sitting around the table when that's being discussed. Anyway, Stoltenberg also talked about what kind of weapons exactly that they're trying to get to the Ukrainians.
What weapons did he say he needed most?
Well, he went to different types of weapons, including everything from air defense, heavy armor, jets. I'll leave it to Minister Resnikov and the Ukrainians here to describe exactly what kind of needs they have. But that's the reason why it is important to meet here in Ramstein, to sit down with Ukrainians and to discuss in detail what are the needs, what are the gaps, and how can NATO allies and partners in the US-led contact group ensure that we are providing them the support they need as soon as possible. Then, in my discussions with President Zelensky, I of course recognize the importance of discussing new capabilities, and the support for Ukraine has evolved as the war has evolved. In the beginning, the focus was on light anti-tank weapons like the Javelins and the Enlows. Then the focus was on artillery, and then a long time, the main focus was on air defense, modern air defense systems like Patriots and NASAMS. And I welcome the fact that now there are Patriots in place, German and US Patriots in place in Ukraine. And over the last weeks, we have a lot of focus on armor, on battle tanks, and battle tanks are now coming into to Ukraine. And we need to continue to discuss, and jets are also being delivered by allies to Ukraine. We need to continue to discuss specific platforms. But as important as discussing new platforms, it is extremely important to ensure that all the platforms which are already in Ukraine work and function as they should, meaning that we need ammunition, we need spare parts, we need fuel, we need maintenance, we need repair, we need all the sustainment to ensure that all the systems which are already there are delivering the effect that they should. So therefore, not only discuss new systems, but also discuss how to ensure that existing systems function.
Well, they're still talking in terms of how Ukraine can win the war. Now, it's pretty obvious to those who are objectively observing the situation, and I read a lot about this, is that they're not winning the war and they haven't got any chance of winning the war. At a certain point, they are going to collapse. So all of this, NATO is then going to be shown to be a paper tiger. So they've really got, and there are, I mean, this leak that's taken place may well be elements within the deep state who are suddenly realizing that they need an off ramp, because a catastrophic defeat in Ukraine by the Russians will simply destroy NATO and it won't exist. So never mind Ukraine joining it, it simply will disintegrate.
Well, we've got a big problem, haven't we? Running out of ammunition, running out of fuel and no spares. So when your tank breaks down, you just have to abandon it.
Well, if you run out of ammunition, then the game's up, isn't it? You're being pulverised and you can't fire back. At that point, you either surrender or die, and then the Russian army will be able to go wherever it wants in the Ukraine because nobody will be able to stop it.
Can you talk
unless
about...
NATO tries to prevent them, but they've got no forces to do it. Where are the forces to do that? NATO hasn't got the forces to do that.
They're at Ramstein in Germany, which seems to be the main US base there. You know, so this is the place where all the drone killings around the world were being coordinated from, as Glenn Greenwald dug out a few years ago. It's a little bit of America in Germany, isn't it?
It is, and of course...
Weapons base there.
Yeah, well, the Americans have got 180-some-odd bases all around the world, and they're essentially, they are like parasites everywhere. The money that is spent in those bases and then into the local economy is, in fact, the US trade deficit, as Hudson's pointed out. You could balance the books in the US by closing down the bases. But, of course, that means you wouldn't be running the world anymore, and, hey, we can't think about that.
So, anyway, he was also asked by one of the journalists about the timetable for Ukraine to join NATO. There are a few eyebrows being raised, so what's the timing?
Does NATO have a timetable when Ukraine could enter NATO?
So all NATO allies have agreed that Ukraine will become a member. President Zelensky has a very clear expectation. We discussed this, both the issue of membership but also security guarantees. And of course, Ukraine needs security because no one can tell when and how this war ends. But what we do know is that when the war ends, we need to ensure that history doesn't repeat itself, that Russia is not able to continue to attack and to wage war again against Ukraine and to continue to chip away at European security. So we need a discussion about a security framework. We need, there is an ongoing discussion about membership. But my message was, first, Ukraine's rightful place is in NATO, as allies have agreed, but also that the main focus now is to ensure that Ukraine prevails. Because if Ukraine doesn't prevail as a sovereign independent nation in Europe, there is no meaning in discussing membership, and we need to preserve the unity in supporting Ukraine, and that's the main focus also of the meeting today.
So, yes, that's the final clip from Jens Stoltenberg over in both in Ukraine and in Germany, Martin. And I wonder if any of the Germans have asked him, why did you blow up the Nord Stream pipeline?
Well, I mean, that's out there floating around, isn't it? You can see the dilemma they're in. For Ukraine to be in NATO, they have to win the war, but they can't win the war, so they can't join NATO. And that, of course, what will happen is that the Russians will impose the solution. If there's no negotiations, then it looks to me as if the negotiating track is over. The Russians are going to win the war, however long it takes, because they're obviously in for the long haul, and they will dictate to the losers what the peace is. And that's exactly what NATO did in Kosovo and Serbia and all the rest of it. If you're going to tell people what to do, you've got to beat them. And well, if you can't beat them, you can't tell them what to do.
Speaking right now here in Bristol, at the Malcolm X Centre in St Paul's, probably right this minute, is MEP Claire Daly. And, yes, so she is an Irish independent. Do you want to say something about her, Martin? Because it's a fair voting system, as we have with the European Parliament, the only trouble is, of course, that the European Parliament is just a talking shop, really.
It is, but, I mean, it does allow her, as an independent socialist, I think she would describe herself, to get elected, because European parliamentary elections, as you say, are on a proportional basis. And so if you get enough votes, you'll get at least one person elected.
Here she is in the European Parliament, making the point that Ukraine is burning through a whole generation of men.
Listening to the cheerleading in here, safe and secure, thousands of miles away from the front lines, I think it would be a useful exercise for us to remind ourselves about what ordinary Ukrainians are experiencing. The Economist reports of forced recruitment across the country. Draftees with no experience or training are being sent to the front in what a UK minister calls First World War levels of attrition. Casualty figures are secret, but we know their estimates of about 120,000. Battalion commanders tell the Washington Post of recruits fleeing positions en masse. Politico reports a crackdown on deserters. These are human beings, and there is a shameful lack of empathy for ordinary people in the war rhetoric in here. The debate is about keeping the weapons flowing to keep the war going. Ukraine is burning through a generation of men, sons, husbands, brothers who can never be replaced. This cannot go on indefinitely. And ye sickening war generals who sit in here and will these men to our deaths, you make me sick. We need peace. We need dialogue, however unpleasant that may be.
So when Henry Kissinger selected Ursula von der Leyen to be the President of Europe at the Bilderberg meeting, I think, maybe it was anyway, she was Defence Minister in Germany at the time. He knew what he was doing, Martin, didn't he? Because the EU has been 100% behind the Americans and NATO when it comes to Ukraine.
Well, that's because the NATO is the controller of the EU. I mean, it's simple as that, really, isn't it? And, of course, Britain not being in the EU, we're still in control of NATO, and through NATO, control the EU.
I mean,
there we go. It's the British who've been pushing for the most belligerent approach.
Claire Daly, this MEP, someone I haven't really heard much of. You heard of her?
Well, I've heard of her, obviously, because she's taken an interest in the Ukraine issue, and she's been a lonely voice of her and her colleague, whose name I've forgotten, in the European Parliament, and she's taken an awful lot of stick. I mean, that was from the heart speech, was it not?
Yes, it was, yeah. And not one of these kind of scripted AI speeches on an auto cue that we get from so many of our political leaders. Anyway, here's Claire Daly with a longer clip from her giving a talk where she's not actually speaking in the European Parliament, but to a little conference.
The militarisation of Europe itself has moved us away from what the EU was supposed to be, playing a rational and a constructive role in world affairs, seeking diplomatic engagement with adversaries, attempting to defuse conflicts, treating our opponents in good faith, to now playing quite a negative role. Now the European Union is playing strategic games. It's actually raising tensions. It's instrumentalising third countries. It's striking aggressive postures that can only lead to escalation. And that is utterly tragic on the world scale. I mean, we had the benefit of going on a visit to Pakistan before Christmas, and a whole number of people, political actors and others, said it's so sad to see Europe just coattailing the US like this. Europe could have played a different role on the world scale, arguing for peace, being more down the middle. Why did it do this? It's sad, and it is incredibly sad. And I don't want to go into the details about the war in Ukraine. We can maybe deal with this in the discussion. There is obviously, you know, I'm not excusing Russia for crossing the line. They take full responsibility for that. They were in breach of the UN Charter. They should not have invaded Ukraine. But we have to take the background context into account and the role of NATO in destabilising the situation, in escalating tensions and so on. And unless we take that into account, we can't come to understand how we might get a lasting peace in Europe. So one of the things I think is the urgency of the EU's militarisation at the moment. I'm sure for people here, the step of sending the Leopard tanks to Ukraine was a new red line, and it was quite shocking in some ways. But actually, really what the EU is doing is sending just enough to keep it going without tipping Russia over the edge. And that's the backdrop. And I think reading back over the series of crises that led to World War One and Two, I am really struck by how terrifyingly similar the present moment is. I mean, there's no obvious way out of this crisis. The path to military escalation kind of operates like a ratchet. Tensions can go up, they can stabilise, but they can't be really reduced. And the more things get entrenched, the more trapped we become in this logic of kind of escalation, the less agency then any of us actually have, or any government even has, in escaping this slide into ever greater conflict. So increasingly we have uncontrolled and unpredictable events which can push tensions higher, which can worsen relations, burn bridges for peace, push politicians and governments to overreact. And I think we are seeing now once in a decade events happening with great frequency. I mean, the sabotage of Nord Stream 2, the Kerch Bridge explosion, the tragic deaths of the rocket accident in Poland. Each or any one of those, and we have to expect more of these, is a possible trigger for a breakout war, a chain reaction that could bring new hostilities, an acceleration of the horror towards a generalised conflict. And, you know, I think that the overriding priority for progressive forces in Europe has to be preventing that from happening. That's the key, I suppose, to this talk. And, you know, we need to bring peace. And elementary as this statement is, it's made to sound like it's opposite. Because since the invasion commenced, there has been an absolute hurricane of pro-war propaganda. And that's not accidental. I mean, you've probably felt it here, but it's emanating from strategic communication centres in NATO and amongst Western governments, all on message. So anyone who says don't send arms to Ukraine is leaving them defenceless. Same people never say that about Palestine. They never say send weapons to Iraq to defend themselves against US invasion. But suddenly now we have to send weapons to Ukraine. And all of the messages that you've been getting, the traditional media have been converted into really full-time propaganda organs for the pro-war narrative, actively misrepresenting arguments for peace, inciting hatred, dehumanising and ridiculing critical voices. I mean, I was a member of the Irish Parliament for many years and well known and so on, but we have been, along with Mick Wallace, we have been absolutely demonised for our anti-war stance. We're an embarrassment, we're a disgrace, the whole thing. I've never seen anything like it, and that's obviously replicated across Europe, but I know anti-war activists have got the same thing. So the first thing, I suppose, we have this really bizarre inversion of reality which has occurred, where political forces who supported every act of aggression Every crime against the UN Charter, every assault on a foreign country carried out by Europe and its allies have now reinvented themselves as the defenders of international law. So the same territorial integrity and sovereignty that they overlook in regions of Asia, the Middle East, North Africa, the Sahel, Central and South America are for the moment sacred and absolute principles now in terms of Ukraine. And those of us who have defended for our whole lives and still defend them in the present case, we're the revisionists, you know. Speaking up for peace now is support for the aggressor. Accepting nothing less than the military defeat of Russia, whatever that cost is supposed to be the only legitimate path to peace.
So that's Claire Daly there speaking at a recent conference. Martin, she's a pretty feisty lady. If only she had a bit of power.
Well, obviously, as you say, being a member of the European Parliament, a backbencher, all you've got is the platform to say, what you want to say.
They don't really have front benches there, do they? Because
no,
the commission, which is their sort of equivalent of the cabinet, is all, it's not elected. It's people who are selected for the job. But anyway, we're going to hop on now to look at Ray McGovern. Now, sound engineer Dave here sent me this, and it's absolutely fascinating. I'll put a full version of this up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk tonight, because he gives us a sort of post-World War II history of the US foreign policy, the Central Intelligence Agency, and then kind of winds up by having a good old look at Ukraine.
When you look at what Putin orchestrates in terms of what questions are asked him, and I don't think he orchestrates everyone, but I think this one he did, again, at Valdai on October 27th. One of these reporters says, Mr. President, I'm thinking of traveling to Odessa in several months. Do you think I should apply for a Ukrainian visa or Russian visa? Pretty clever, huh? So Putin says, Odessa. A beautiful city. No more beautiful city than Odessa. But, you know, Odessa has become, what do you call it, an item of conflict, okay? Oh, yeah. He borrowed from the Trojan War. A yabloka razdora. Yabloka is apple, okay? You know about the apple that started the Trojan War, okay? A yabloka razdora is conflict, or Odessa could be a way to resolve our differences in a rational way. Whoa, what's he saying? Well, I'm saying he says all this very deliberately, having planted the question, and he's saying, look, you need, if you're going to have a viable Ukraine that is anything other than just a farmland for the rest of Europe, you need to have access to the Black Sea. We can take Odessa in 2 weeks. We'll stop there. If you deal, you can have a viable Ukrainian state with Odessa, but we're going to have to be up to the Dnieper, all except Odessa, and we're going to have to be as far forward to protect ourselves from the range of weapons that you put in the west of Ukraine. Both Lavrov and Putin have said, now it comes to geography. If you put in missile weaponry or other weaponry that reaches 100 miles, that means geography will dictate that we go 100 more miles to the west. It's very simple. So, in other words, this is not McGovern just making up Odessa. This is Putin mentioning Odessa, and it could be a yabloka razdora, an object, an apple of discord, or it could be a way to arrange these things. Now, did anyone mention that in the press? No. Did anybody pick up on that by these benighted people like Jacob Sullivan and Tony Blinken? Not that I know of. I doubt that any analyst in the CIA, getting back to our original discussion, would have the guts to report. Look, looks like Putin is offering a little suggestion here, guys. You might want to think about it, because the prevailing sentiment is so anti-Russian, is so controlled, and so it would be a really courageous thing to do, to say, look, you know, there's maybe a way out of this. and maybe that person would not get promoted for the next 2 decades. It's, you know, it comes down to that. And also the people that I mentioned, the kind that are run by these malleable managers now, it's really bad. And I doubt that that Sullivan or Blinken, and certainly not Victoria Nuland in the State Department, is going to get any of these little straws in the wind that people like Putin put out. This one was a big one, Odessa. I don't think they even were told about it. And I don't think, like me, they read those speeches and the Q&A. Do these folks really believe that Russia wants to take over Europe or the rest of the world still? I mean, it did at one point, right? I just don't know. They are very poorly educated. The people who were educated by the people who educated me knew about Russia, knew about Russian history, knew about Russia's experience in World War II, knew a lot about Russia, okay, how they look at things. What I'm saying here is that what does Tony Blinken know about Russia or Jacob Sullivan? Zippo. So who do they listen to? They listen to Michael McFaul, head of Stanford policy on, you know, he's a professor at Stanford, and he was ambassador to Russia under Obama, and before that he was director of Russian analysis at the National Security Council. He knows all about Russia. So what does he say? 3 days ago, after Xi Jinping and Putin demonstrated in an unmistakable way that there's a new alliance here that the West has to take into account, what does Michael McFaul say in a tweet? He says, aha, now Putin has humiliated Xi Jinping. Because even though they said in their joint statement that no country should put nuclear weapons in other countries, now Putin has said he's going to do precisely that in Belarus. This is not going to go down well in Beijing, says Michael McFaul. Now, that joint statement was boilerplate. Every time they say this kind of thing, they say, no, you don't put weapons in, nuclear weapons in other countries, like the U.S. has done with 5 countries in NATO, okay? So it's boilerplate. Now, to think that this guru of Russian studies at Stanford and the guy who's talking into the ear of Blinken and Sullivan is telling them, don't worry about it. You know, Xi Jinping is going to be very offended because Putin just humiliated him, okay? One day after that, apparently, the Chinese defense minister didn't get the memo because they announced a step up, a real increase in joint exercises, in joint training, in joint maneuvers of all kinds in the military sphere. So, you know, here's the military reflection of this closeness, and McFaul is trying to have everyone believe that no, Russia and China, they're still at loggerheads. He told Biden to say that at the first summit in June 16th, 2001. Biden said after the summit, this is inappropriate for me to tell you what I told Mr. Putin, but he's got this long border with China, several thousand miles. He knows that China aspires to be the most powerful country, not just economically, but in the whole world, and especially in Asia. He's being squeezed by China. Biden's word. Now, I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall when Putin turned to his colleagues watching the boob tube, watching Biden say this before he got on the plane. He said, huh? Oh my God, you know? So these guys don't get it. More recently, Biden, apropos of nothing, said, you know, I'm convinced that Xi Jinping doesn't trust Putin. I wouldn't trust him because he's a killer. I mean, so this is never, never land, which would be funny, but it ain't funny. because these people cannot take the people running stuff in our country seriously. And so they have to be prepared for the worst. The worst is going to come. The denouement is going to come in Ukraine. It's not going to come in Asia. You're quite right, Kim. The U.S. would be crazier than crazy to challenge the Chinese military in Asia. I mean, something like supply lines apply here, right? So I just want to say that this insight came to me when McFaul said, Putin has humiliated Xi Jinping out of China. This is not going to go well down China. Well, you know, this is so missing the point on the tectonic shift that it explains to me why Blinken, Sullivan, Nuland can say, well, Ambassador McFaul says this, and he's teaching a new course on this. Just started today, mind you. He announced it on Twitter about this great power relationship. He must know, and he is just as responsible as anyone else for the fact that the growing trust that I talked about in 2013 dissipated into the abominable situation that exists now in relations between Russia and the United States. And I've been watching these relations for six decades now. I'm ashamed to admit I've never seen it worse or more dangerous.
Well, former CIA analyst Ray McGovern there. Martin, you know, he's, I think, a terrific. I mean, I'll put a full version of that interview up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Never, never land, never more dangerous. Jake Sullivan keeps popping up, doesn't he? This is the guy, the Bilderberger, that was responsible for the Nord Stream pipeline, according to Cy Hirsch, at National Security Council guy in the States. So it's an element of evil here, really evil, because, I mean, we were just hearing, weren't we, about the Ukrainians being urged to fight, but running out of ammo, spares, fuel, that sort of thing. So being told by NATO to keep fighting, even though, of course, they can't fight without those things. And the same with the complete ignorance, supposed ignorance, of the people in the White House running the Ukraine war.
Yeah, I mean, what's increasingly clear is that they're not necessarily rational in their strategy. They're evil, for sure, but they're not necessarily rational, and they're certainly not omnipotent. And it reminds me, in the run-up to Kissinger and Nixon's visit to China in 1971, whenever it was, when they flipped the Chinese into the Western camp, in the run-up before that, James Jesus Angleton, who was head of counterintelligence at the CIA, he was definitely pushing the idea, and of course, Ray McGovern, being ex-CIA, will know exactly what I'm talking about, that the idea that the Chinese and the Russians had fallen out was a trick, and that the West was being tricked, that in actual fact the communists were working together, but they were just pretending not to in order to try and,
Yeah, but just hang on. Let's go back to World War II, because Stalin was completely convinced that the Ribbentrop-Molotov pact was cast iron, wasn't he?
No.
Suddenly, bang, it all went.
Yeah, but I mean, Alex Crane has pointed out, Stalin only did the Molotov-Ribbentrop pact because of Munich, because if the British had said to the Czechs, we're ready to fight, and the Russian Red Army said we will come to Jackson Lake.
You missed the point there, really, because what I'm saying is that at the top level, when there's all sorts of manipulation going on, suddenly what looks like a steadfast alliance can disappear just like that.
It can, but of course the point of having intelligence services is that they tell you what's really going on.
Well, they don't, though, do they? Weapons of mass destruction and all that nonsense. Well, you should never listen to them again.
The point about James Jesus Angleton is he was pushing basically false analysis. You know, it's just false analysis. It was just wrong. The Chinese and the Russians had indeed fallen out.
He was a completely useless guy,
so,
wasn't
he? So you've now got the exact opposite, where when China and Russia are being bosom pals, we're being told that in actual fact they're enemies, when it's quite clear that they're not.
I'm not saying that they are, but all I'm saying is that these things can change.
Well, they can change, but if you've got decent intelligence service, it'll tell you what's most likely going on,
especially,
rather than just making it up.
Especially in this Orwellian world, where Oceania might suddenly become your enemy rather than your ally overnight.
Yes, but that's fiction, Tony. I'm not saying it can't happen, but proper intelligence analysis is that you actually work out what is the likelihood of that. It can happen. Yeah, it does happen, but often you've got to know what's going on.
Because the intelligence analysis is often deliberately wrong. Anyway, look, I thought of it just as a sort of curveball here. We'd have a listen to some analysis from Israel of what's going on in Ukraine. And this is a guy called Stephen Bannoun getting a chance to speak here.
Welcome back to Raising the Frequency with Tim and Shannon.
Top of the morning to you.
And I have one of my favorite guests coming on, Stephen Bannoun. He's with Israeli News Live. And why I love him so much is because this cat is not only believes in Christ, but he is one of the most incredibly informed soul of what's going on with anything going around the world. And he has no boundary where we could talk about politics,
everything,
to UFOs, to the extraterrestrial agenda.
To
me, that's open-mindedness and light on your feet. So without further ado, welcome Stephen Bannoun.
Thank you. Thank you guys for having me on here today.
Well, you know,
we needed you.
Yeah, there's so much going on right now around the world. You wake up that also Americans wake up. Oh, we're in an official war with China and Russia. And now Iran is looks like we're going to be with Iran as well soon enough. Mexico is we want to go to war with Mexico because Mexico's siding with these other countries. It just seems like, Stephen, that either things are just falling apart or certain things are being orchestrated to make it look like it's falling apart.
Well, I would say it's falling apart, but it also is orchestrated to fall apart. That would probably be the better way to put it. And of course, all these fronts that we're looking at are fronts that we've known for some time we're going to manifest. We're going to have more fronts yet manifesting still yet, Tim. The way I understood this from the beginning is that, of course, we already know we have Russia, Ukraine. That was going to escalate. They're anticipating some time. And when I say anticipating, this is according to the AI that determines or evaluates what war fronts are going to happen next that the Joint Chiefs use. And they had figured between October and November that Russia would then strike Germany and possibly the UK. Initially, they thought it was just going to be the UK. But once they introduced the Leopard tanks into the theater for Ukraine, they knew that Putin will go after Germany. And that will then spark China to go after Taiwan, because we will then get involved. Not to say that we're not already involved. We're very involved in the war in Ukraine. But it would be then more open to the rest of the
world. It won't be a proxy war anymore. It'll be a direct war.
Exactly. And quite frankly, it is a direct war, guys, because what they're not telling you is that, like, for example, when we send in the HIMARS missile systems, and then we send in the crew that says, well, okay, we're going to train the Ukrainians on how to use that particular system. Not really. That's just what we say. But in reality, we send in our own teams to run these missile systems. And because, quite frankly, Ukrainian soldiers, there's not many left. They are, one of the last things that I've heard was that the Ukrainian military was going around in white vans looking for any able-bodied man could fight. They don't even care if they're underage at this point, as long as they're big enough to fight. They give them an AK, no grenades or nothing. They take them to the front lines and just drop them off.
Oh, my gosh.
Stephen Bannoun who's apparently an Israeli analyst, although he sounds like an American. He's probably just
moved. He's talking about the State Department, like Iowa State Department.
Over there,
he?
Yeah. Lots going on, of course, in Ukraine. Apparently the Ukrainians were planning attacks on Russians in Syria. The NATO chief, as we've just heard, says Ukraine's rightful place now is in NATO, and that all the leaders of NATO have agreed. I suppose that includes the newly joined Finns as well, for Ukraine to join NATO. Lawmakers in the US say they won't support unrestrained Ukraine aid. That's the Republicans in the States. And the Ukrainian foreign minister, lastly, has been slamming the European Union for not delivering enough ammunition.
Well, I mean, there's panic in the ranks, isn't there? Because they thought that the sanctions on Russia would crash the Russian economy and Putin would be out in his ear. That's not what's happening. What's going to happen across Europe is that the existing political leadership will be turfed out as a result of the collapse of the European economy. Meanwhile, the Russians, with all their natural resources and their stable mixed economy with a nationalised arms industry, are going to be doing good business with the Chinese as we all go down the drain. And they're going to lose the war, hopefully quicker rather than longer.
Dominic Raab's gone from our Department of Justice, but in America, Biden's Department of Justice has indicted four Americans for their political views on Russia. The allegation is that members of the African People's Socialist Party were involved in a foreign malign influence campaign. So are we involved in a foreign malign influence campaign on this show, Martin?
I think some people would regard that as being the case. No doubt in the integrity
initiative. We're not foreign.
Ah, but we're working for the Russians, you see, Tony.
But surely we're patriotic Brits.
Well, we might say that, but you see, you know, the deep state doesn't regard us as necessarily, you know, they own the state, and we are just tenants in our own country.
Interesting that it's the African People's Socialist Party. I suppose they are seen as immigrants, migrants, and foreigners rather than Americans.
Well, the African Socialist Party is made up of many generations people who've lived in the United States. They just happen to be black.
And they're saying that the allegation against these Americans is that they're involved in a foreign malign influence campaign directed by Russia's Federal Security Service, the FSB.
You see what's happened with the...
It's like a smear to me.
Yeah, well, of course it's a smear.
It's a smear.
But whereas
and it was to shut them down, basically.
Yes, well, I mean, it's a way of intimidating those who speak out about Russia, yeah, or about Ukraine, the Ukraine war. Claire Daly has been accused of being, you know, a Putin-loving, you know, whatever, whatever. I'm afraid this kind of bad mouthing of people who don't agree with you is becoming
the norm. But
it's
not bad mouthing, it's jailing.
Oh, yes. Oh, jailing, yes.
And also shutting down their media operation or whatever.
So, in other words, because we are going to war with Russia, because we're...
Are we?
Oh, yes, because if Ukraine joins NATO, we're going to war with Russia. That's the implication, Tony. Mm. So, what's going on in the Ukraine, it's going to be happening here. And, of course, there won't be any tax cuts for any wealthy people, and there's going to have to be rationing and all sorts of things. People haven't really thought this through, have they?
Some people, I suppose, are thinking that we can win that war. Are they or not?
Well, they are.
They care. Maybe they don't care.
Well, to some extent, they don't care because some people are making a load of money out of this. The Ukrainian mafia are in, you know, they're
is
in
it a mechanism to bring in a totalitarian state?
Yes, it is. But of course, the real problem is not that we're going to live in a totalitarian state, is that human civilization is going to be destroyed through war. And it's not that we're not going to live in a terrible future.
It's kind of not in Ukraine, is it? That they are being told you're going to fight, but they're not being given the ammunition to do it.
Well, even if they wanted to give them the ammunition, there's two problems. A, we haven't got any to give them. And B, how would we get it there? If NATO was to get involved in the Ukraine, they'd have to ship loads and loads of military forces from all the US bases all over the world into Romania. Before they got there, the Russians would sink all the ships they were on with their missiles. There is no way that Russia can be defeated in this war. Now, that's the good news, Tony. Because if they could be defeated, then the bad guys in the West could have a hope.
So why are our so-called leaders banging our heads against a brick wall?
Because they don't know what else to do. They've got themselves into this situation where they thought that they could crash the Russian economy, and it turns out they couldn't.
So are they bumbling or evil?
Both. And it's a good job they are bumblers, because otherwise we really would be in trouble, wouldn't we?
Okay, we're going to take our look at the upcoming coronation now. One of the people who's been speaking out against King Charles is an organic farmer called Sir Julian Rose. Actually, not sure if he's a Sir Julian Rose. I've seen
a couple of Sir Julian Rose.
Who's got a farm on the Thames, and which I visited a few years ago. And he's very much a campaigner against 5G and things like that. But anyway, he was on Richard Vobes' programme this week talking about King Charles. He's extremely annoyed that Charles is now going along with all this pro-GM stuff after having, for decades, led the organic movement, which Julian Rose is part of.
The club, actually, it's even called the firm within royal circles, which royalty represents, is a hugely wealthy organisation. It's a form of corporation, actually. It's not just a nice family with a lot of money. following some old rituals from the past, which we all find rather enjoyable. It's actually a corporation with an agenda. And unfortunately, while the agenda might have been something pro-human a while back, and I think you have to go quite a long way back, actually, certainly beyond the Queen, further back than her, who was already out of control once she was in power. The agenda is the same agenda as the globalist agenda now. And I think the reason why it's happened this way is because the need, or at least the belief of people in power within royalty, is that they must hold on to their empire at all costs. And in order to do that, you really have to be, so to speak, working shoulder to shoulder with the biggest organizations on the planet, which are the ones associated with globalization and are made up of all the leading corporations of the planet and all the major banking organizations of the planet. Now, if you do that, you're going into territory which is essentially the New World Order. And you can't compromise under this situation. Although what the king has tried to do was to have one foot in each camp. He tried to say, well, I very much appreciate and want to support organic farming and environmental issues. And he wants the image that the public receive to be that image. But the other image, which has got out willy-nilly because he opened the recent Davos forum for the WEF only a year ago with a speech announcing that we have to follow the edicts of the Green New Deal, of the Great Reset, of the Fourth Industrial Revolution. He actually was there. He was the first person to really announce this. So he's compromised 100%. It's a position of complete hypocrisy. I'm personally not going to bring in what I feel about the individual. I'm saying this. One cannot represent one's people and take a coronation oath, which he will be in 3 weeks' time, saying that he will protect the integrity of the people and the sovereignty of his nation, while at the same time standing shoulder to shoulder with Klaus Schwab and an organization which is interested in dismantling the nation state completely. Mm-hmm. And not only dismantling the nation state, of altering everything which we take as a positive tradition. And since we're discussing food, you can take that as a very central issue indeed, because actually the plan under the Green New Deal is to indeed make most food synthetic. So it will be Petri dish products, which are grown in laboratories, which will become factories, and they will range through almost every product, particularly meat and dairy products. And then vegetables will be grown in huge hydroponic factories where they drip water with chemicals in it into large vats, and all the plants grow out of that. There's no soil involved at all. Now, this is all spelt out. If anyone wants to research it, it's all in the public domain, this information. You can find it if you look on the WEF website, for example, or in Klaus Schwab's book. It's all spelt out. Mm. So we have no reason to be surprised. You know, we ought to know this by now. So food is going to be taken over under these conditions, because the theory is if you're going to save the planet from global warming, you must cease having any livestock on the land. You must, they fart and they burp, and those two things are extremely bad news, apparently, and are going to cause the entire world to get hot very quickly, and we're all going to get fried.
That's Sir Julian Rose there. Seems to have fallen out with one of his neighbour organic farmers, King Charles Martin, and he's saying, well, look, he needs to just get off the fence.
Well, he has got off the fence, hasn't he? He's in the Davos camp, and he's in favour of the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution. Couldn't be clearer. We know what side he's on.
What about what he's saying there about the nation stakes? I know you're an internationalist, a socialist internationalist. What do you think about that one? Because, I mean, it certainly doesn't look, if you're going to have a kind of internationalist world government, that it's going to be a socialist one, is it?
The internationalist world government will be run by the deep state in the West. That's the only international government there.
Aren't you playing into their hands by being an internationalist, the globalist hands?
No. Internationalism is not the same as globalism. Globalism is about an economic strategy, neoliberalism, privatisation, creation of non-farm food production, all of this, and that's not internationalism. Internationalists show solidarity with people who are being oppressed, whether it's the people in the Donbass or the people in Zimbabwe back in the 70s who were fighting for access to land. The idea that there is a supranational government going to be imposed by the West is there. They've got the strategy. The problem is that standing in their way is the Russian army that won World War II and the Chinese economy, which is going to show them what mixed economy can look like if you really know what you're doing. And they can't compete with it because of their financialized infrastructure.
Okay,
They're going to lose.
Back to the coronation, and the big issue seems to be, we're talking here about something megally historic, actually. If King Charles wants to change the order of service, etc., and his oaths, so that he's going to be the defender of faiths and all faiths rather than the Christian Church, that's, I think, it's about 1,200 years the coronation oaths have included allegiance to the Christian faith, Martin. I know it's something you don't necessarily agree with, but it is going to be a massive change, isn't it? It's almost like a kind of Henry VIII moment, really.
Well, I'm not sure that he is. Is he
going to be allowed to?
Well, I'm just asking the question.
Well, it looks like he is. Yeah.
Well, if he is, he is. So there we are.
Anyway, a Catholic scholar, what is he? He's a layman, actually, an author and a commentator. Gavin Ashenden has had quite a lot to say about King Charles. He's saying he's cutting off the roots of the monarchy from Jesus, and he's doing it at his peril.
And the reason that Jesus is the only way to the Father is that it was only in Jesus that the Godhead entered creation in order to square the impossible circle of free will, holiness, justice, forgiveness, and love. To the surprise of many, the English, now British, concept of both kingship and coronation grows organically out of this ideology of particularity. The ritual of anointing, central to the heart of the coronation ritual, finds its origins in the prophet Samuel anointing the shepherd boy David as king of Israel. This anointing expresses an exclusive mutual covenant of purpose between God and his anointed. This purpose will flow like a river cascading from a single spring towards the estuary of the incarnation, in which God will expand his invitation to the rest of his creation, from the estuary to the wide sea of all his children, but always embedded and personified in the particular as a way of reaching out to the universal. Particularity indeed precedes the universal. And this conflict between Charles and his church is because Charles's values and philosophy, defending all the faiths while reflecting the culture of the age, not only reverses this relation of the particular to the universal, but it wipes out the claims of the unique particulars of Jesus, who becomes a way, not the way. So does this matter to the coronation? The monarchy as a concept is not just a matter of power, for that we could go to Nietzsche, nor is it, in fact, a matter of social and political self-actualization, for that we can go to Jung and the therapists or the social workers. All its ritual, in fact, flows from the experience of God breaking into history in a unique and very particular way that found its ultimate expression in Jesus, the Logos, on the cross. A sacrifice of love drawing each one of us into the intimacy of forgiveness and a relationship with Abba. Now, Muslims reject this. It is, in fact, a profound offense to the unknowability and inaccessibility of Allah, whose primary demand is not the adoration of the forgiven, but the submission of the recalcitrant. Abba, Allah and Yahweh are different. In fact, all other religions reject Jesus in the terms he presents himself. The anointing of the monarch, however, borrows from the anointing of the episcopate and the priesthood, which derive from Jesus and the prophetic anointings. In the office of the monarch, power and service, state and God, authority and accountability Cohen here, it is not essentially an exercise in the development of the theory of constitutional monarchy. It's a slow and steady adaptation of the vision of the relationship between God and humanity, set in the organic expression of a Christian state. Multicultural and interreligious relativism is an offense and a repudiation of the unique claims of Jesus, embodied in the building of the abbey in which the coronation takes place. The office of king is not a delegation of symbolic authority from the demos, the people, in pursuit of a personal or political development. It is, in fact, the inheritance of an office which reflects the pursuit of a particular balance between heaven and earth, between Christ and his church, between power, protection, authority, and service. These virtuous paradoxes find their roots in the incarnation of Jesus, and Charles cuts off his kingly roots at his and our peril.
Well, I wish Dr. Gavin Ashenden would get a better microphone or something, but anyway, sorry about the burbling noise in the back of that. But Martin, this is quite an important point he's making here, isn't it? He has to decide multi-faith or Christian, and he's trying to fudge it, basically, isn't he?
Well, it'll be interesting to see how this cookie crumbles, won't it? But let's put it this way. When Henry VIII took the Church of England, created the Church of England, he rebelled against the authority of the Pope. And in actual fact, if we're going to be consistent about this, the monarchy should not, in fact, be the head of the Church of England. We should all still be Roman Catholics and answerable to the Pope, because the Pope is absolutely directly responsible, according to the historical things. He is the representative of God on earth. That's what Catholics believe.
Shouldn't we go back to the Celtic Church, really?
Well,
because the Catholics usurped that, didn't they?
Yeah, you could argue that there's all sorts of different kinds of Christianity, as there are.
You don't need to argue it. Of course there are.
So in other words,
you've got Orthodox Ukrainian and Orthodox Russian at loggerheads.
Yes, you have. And so, in other words, when he says, I uphold the faith, if he chooses that particular formulation, it's not Christianity in general he's upholding, it's Anglicanism. So, in other words, if you're a nonconformist or a Catholic, you cannot be King of England. That is still on the statute book. It was brought in 1688.
Well, I think that may be all about to change.
Well, if he does go for, as you say, defender of faiths, then it will change. But it changed when Henry VIII changed it. Things change, Tony.
I'm not saying.
Maybe we should get rid of the monarchy altogether and have a secular state, which is what I would favour.
But it's quite clear that the Anglican Church around the world has been pushing back. I see Justin Welby lying through his teeth on the news. I think it was in it Wednesday, saying, "Oh, there's no problem at all. There's no conflict going on." Well, of course, Welby's in that job just to come along and say things like that to deny that there is any conflict between the Anglican Church and Charles, and there clearly is.
Well, I think that what will happen is, because the rules are the rules. We were talking about the rules being the rules in relation to Dominic Raab earlier in the show. He will have to use the formula, the faith. Mm. And if he doesn't, then there's an issue. But of course, what it really means is we shouldn't have a monarchy at all, and we shouldn't have to be arguing on this basis at all. And in fact, in many countries, they don't have one. In the United States,
wonderful,
when it was set up in 1976...
countries like America, there's no monarchy. And aren't they a brilliant country?
No, they're not a brilliant country, right. But they don't have a monarchy with the problems that monarchy creates.
Surely it's got nothing to do with that. It's all about the people who are actually in power. And it's actually quite a lot easier to get rid of a president than it is to get rid of a king.
Well, indeed. And that's exactly the argument for a secular state that's run
by
secular.
That's quite a good argument for a monarchy. Quite a good argument for a monarchy, really. I mean, although... Yes, but if you get a decent king, you can't get rid of
a rubbish one.
Yeah, but if you get a good one, you shouldn't be so negative all the time. People are different. People are different. And what happens, it seems, in America is if you get a decent president like Kennedy was, they get their head blown off.
Yes. And if you get a decent king, they can end up being beheaded as well. You know, there you go. It's politics, isn't it?
I mean, the other thing people often brush over is King Charles's links to MI5, MI6, and as he's a colonel-in-chief, I think it is, of all three of GCHQ2. Slowly but surely, he's put himself very much in charge of the British intelligence services.
Well, the British intelligence services use the crown to justify doing anything they like, because they're not answerable to Parliament, they're answerable to the Crown. So that's the legal get-out that they have. And, of course, the Tories have passed these bills which give police, army and intelligence services...
And the Environment Agency.
Above the law.
Yes. Yeah.
So we're talking about a rule of law, except that we're not in it.
It sounds like King Charles thinks he's Judge Dredd. Anyway, thanks very much, Martin. We can have our final item now, which is a bit of a taboo. I like to break those from time to time. And this is a near-death experience by a chap called Dean Braxton.
When I got there, the Holy Spirit didn't jump out of me and say, I got to go back and get somebody else. You literally have the Holy Spirit with you for eternity. You will never not have God on the inside of you.
Wow, that's
good. Most people don't even come to that understanding that God Almighty, He that created everything, lives on the inside
even
of you.
Even when you're in heaven, you'll be full of the Holy Spirit.
You will be full of the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit will be inside of you. I tell people this a lot of times because people say to me, I want to get closer to God. And I say this to them, Dean, God is on the inside of you. How much closer can you get? We don't think that way. So that's where the Holy Spirit is. He's on the inside of you. When you get there, everyone has the Holy Spirit, God Almighty, living on the inside of them. And then there's Jesus, and He was there, okay? I tell people Jesus was 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock to the left of me. I was on my hands and knees giving Him praise. You know what He was doing when I got there? He was strategizing.
What do you mean?
He was literally coming up with plans on how to move certain areas, literally on this planet and in heaven, to get more people to know Him as Lord and Savior. It's not a random, like, oh, it might just happen. And you know how it's moved? He's moved by our prayers. Prayers have substance. When I was leaving this body, you know, when I tell you how fast it took for me to get there, to be absent from the body, to be in the presence of the Lord, the prayers that people were praying for me and others were passing me by.
You could see them.
I could see them. They looked like shooting stars. They weren't shooting stars, but that's the best way I can describe it. And I say they look like because the streaks of light were going past me. Your prayers have substance. Hebrews, the 11th chapter, says faith is what? The substance of things hoped for.
Right.
And most people don't realize that's when you have that prayer life going. Literally, it has substance and things move out of the way.
So that's Dean Braxton there. I'm not certainly not sitting on the fence. Finish off with one of Patrizia's poems. 'Tis said that Jesus made the trip to England long ago, and that his feet in ancient times walked paths we all may know. Down the ages claims were made, Joseph of Arimathea brought Jesus to our pastures green, and Christianity ever near, Jesus well, a place where known, where ancients came to heal loved ones of their ailments and at God's right hand to kneel. One true thing there is no doubt, Christianity came to stay and Jesus travelled far and wide to bring God's love, still here today. And did those feet in ancient times walk upon mountains green? Belief begins in hearts and souls with the love of God and all this means. Thank you, Patrizia. That's all for this week. Time to sign off. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, also lecturer at Lincoln University, Dr. David Hughes, and sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Do send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll find my email address. Don't use Gmail, because Gmail is still blocking the weekly emails that I send out on a Sunday. You will also find this podcast, full-length interviews, story links, comment page, and our email addresses, including that Sir Julian Rose one there. And The Catholic Guy, you can subscribe to my weekly email list and even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I've got two books out, one which is, we mentioned with David Hughes, which is The Traitors of Arnhem, looking at the deals done between Desmond Morton, Churchill's private secretary, and Martin Bormann, Hitler's private secretary at the end of the war, to create a Fourth Reich, and also the connections between the Bilderbergers and the Battle of Arnhem. That's called The Traitors of Arnhem. That costs, what does that one cost? £15, I think, via Bilderberg.org on eBay. And The Siege of Heaven Reader, which looks at secret government from Cromwell to Princess Diana's assassination. This show's repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and at 11:05 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream. And over Sunday breakfast at CambleysRadioQUK.com. Do feel free to make live recordings. We've been streaming live from PRSC in Bristol, the Arts Centre, on the talkradio.org.uk stream. and at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. I'll be remote speaking to you, I think, next week, it looks like, from the National Union of Journalists Conference at the TUC headquarters in London. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream then. God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down.